It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. A great show for you. Wonderful panel. We'll be talking about Ed Snowden. He's on the run. We'll also talk about the worst video game of all time and how it could be made better. A whole lot to come. Stay right here. Twit is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Audio bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by the new Winamp for Android, featuring wireless sync and one-click iTunes import. Now with free daily music downloads and full-length CD listening parties. Download it for free at winamp.com/android. Video bandwidth for Twit is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twit This Week in Tech, episode 411, recorded June 23rd, 2013, inspired by actual events. This Week in Tech is brought to you by 99designs, the world's largest online graphic design marketplace. 99designs connects businesses seeking quality, affordable designs with a community of 200,000 graphic designers. Visit 99designs.com/twit and get your free design consultation. And by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it right from your desk. For our special offer, go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone, and enter Twit. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to Squarespace.com and use the offer code TWIT6. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used Samsung Galaxy, iPhone, or other smartphone is worth at gazelle.com. It's time for This Week in Tech, the show that covers your tech news from the week gone by. And we have a kind of an unusual panel, a fun panel. Starting all the way to my right here, it's Jason Heiner of Tech Republic, the man who got me elected president of the Internet. Thank you, Jason.
Thanks for having me, Leo. Always good to be here.
Eternal fame and fortune. Are you in the conference room there? Are you working on a Sunday?
I am actually at the office doing some site testing and dialing in is better from here.
Well, so, I'm glad. I hope you didn't come in just for us, but I'm glad you're there.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, thank you for being here. Absolutely. From Knoxville? Louisville?
Louisville, Kentucky.
Louisville.
Yes, sir.
I'm told that Tennessee whiskey is not bourbon.
No, it's not. And I love that you always say Louisville correctly, too.
Louisville.
Thank you. Exactly.
I also say Bonner. I found that if you leave the consonants out, you really can't go far wrong, especially south of the Mason-Dixon.
You got it.
Louisville.
You got it.
Man. Yeah. From Paris, it's Patrick Beja. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, how's it going?
Somebody asked.
I'm not in a conference room,
no?
And this is my kitchen.
Well, you and Christina are in the same place, so that's perfect.
Excellent.
Christina Warren from Mashable. Film Girl is in her kitchen / studio apartment in New York City.
It's not a studio. It's a two-bedroom, but the kitchen / our offices are the same.
It's all in the same spot.
It is all in the same. Yep.
So great to see you all. Thank you all for being here. So let me get the scorecard just so I don't want to offend anybody. How many of you are rooting for Edward Snowden to get away? How many think he should be hung from the neck until dead?
There's no third option.
Not according to the Justice Department. Patrick, you're a disinterested party. You're French, right? Or you just talk
funny?
Well,
I don't know. I am French,
okay.
But I don't know that I'm disinterested because all of this story is basically, you know, you've all been discussing, is it legal? Is it not legal? Can you listen to U.S. citizens or not? Apparently, you probably shouldn't be able to do this, but no one cares about the non-U.S. citizens. So I'm very much concerned about this.
That's
about
a good point. We've not been debating that at all. We can listen to you till the cows come
yeah,
home.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, there's no issue there. Well, but just how do you feel about, again, you're a somewhat disinterested part in the
sure,
sense that he didn't violate French law, he violated U.S. law. Is he a traitor? Is he treasonous? Or is he a whistleblower?
It's very difficult to say, isn't it, until we know exactly. I guess, ultimately, we as a society, are going to decide whether or not he is a traitor and whether or not he's just a whistleblower.
I mean, as a society, but ultimately it's the U.S. Justice Department that's going to make the ultimate decision.
Exactly.
Right?
And that's what I mean by we as a society. Right. It's the people making laws, right?
Right.
And judging by these laws. And it obviously he revealed secrets, so that's not in question. The question is, by revealing these secrets, is he a traitor or not? What I would wish for it to happen is for him to get a fair trial. And I'm not exactly sure that's possible. But the best outcome would be for him to get a fair trial. And if he did commit treason, then he should be suffer the consequences, quote unquote. And if he exposed some serious flaws in the system, then I don't know. He should go that route.
Christina?
Yeah, I mean, it's... I'm kind of free Snowden is kind of where I'm at,
yeah,
at this point. I mean, honestly, I mean, I kind of don't understand what's that different about him and Daniel Ellsberg with the Pentagon Papers.
Precisely.
I think that you could make the argument that Bradley Manning is a different case. You know, he was a member of the military. He, you know, revealed things that were of a more sensitive nature that weren't vetted as much. But in this case, I mean, this was a civilian who happened to have a contract job. And if what he's saying is true, then I honestly think that the public value of that information is better than outweighs the, I guess, treasonous implications that they could have.
And you could make the case that Bradley Manning endangered U.S. citizens abroad with his leaks.
Well,
you can't make that case with Edward Snowden.
No, I mean, I think in this case, all it's really doing is the question is, does it endanger kind of the PR for the NSA and for maybe the FBI? And that really is of little concern to me. What I'm not sure about, though, I mean, I guess, is how much is what he saying that is correct and how much is maybe being inflated for his own gains. And that's not really clear yet. But I think that if it is what it seems to be, I mean, honestly, yeah, I'm free Snowden. I mean, I feel like this is why we have whistleblower laws. But to the same point, to Patrick's point, I don't think it's going to be possible for him to get a fair trial. And I mean, I think that the best thing he could hope for is that they somehow violate his looking up his mental health records or something the same way they did with Ellsberg. And that was how he ended up not being prosecuted the Pentagon Papers.
Were caught breaking into a psychiatrist's office.
Right. And so, I mean, you almost have to wonder, you know, if something like that is not to happen, or if it hadn't happened in Ellsberg's case, what would that have meant for the entire narrative of what became the Vietnam War and for Nixon's second term and for a lot of other things? And I mean, I think that's why it's not clear to just maybe classify him as a, you know, someone who's committing treason, because what he's doing could potentially be opening up something that is vital for the public to know about and certainly vital for us to have a discussion about what are our real reasonable expectations of privacy and what does it mean for the Fourth Amendment.
You agree, Jason?
Yes. So first, I'd like to say I always, you know, we live in a democracy, so I always don't like when we talk about it in a democracy and we say, you know, oh, it's the government's fault and that. The government is always
us
in a democracy, right?
Right.
They are accountable and responsible to us. So if we
unless they go so far as to not be, and that's, of course, the great fear of all of this, is that when does it go from being government of the people, by the people, for the people, to government by the governing, for the governing? And that's actually
one of the great concerns here. And I was saying I would like for him to get a fair trial, but at the same time, I'm not even sure it's possible, because even we've seen, at least we suspect, that the NSA has been lying to the different bodies that it's supposed to be answering to, or at least who are supposed to be overseeing their activities. So when it reaches that level of uncertainty, it becomes very murky. Even what you're talking about, Jason, which is we are the government. Are we really, in that case, deciding what happens? We don't even know what happens,
right? So that's where, but we do know now, and that's why I think Snowden ultimately has done something heroic, right? He found the government doing something that it should not have been doing, and he exposed it. I mean, obviously, there's still a lot. Like everyone else, I'd like to read more about the details of what really happened and what else might have been leaked or whatever. It does not appear as if he leaked anything that would cause danger to anyone, any U.S. citizens or military or intelligence. But he did catch the U.S. government doing something that they should not have done. And that's why, ultimately, I think he deserves our support and to stand up for somebody that, has leaked something that we would all like to know about so that we can hold the government accountable for doing something that is sort of extra legal.
And, of course, General James Clapper, who blatantly lied to Congress when asked if the NSA collected this data, he's going to go scot-free. No contempt of Congress there. I think we owe a debt of gratitude to Edward Snowden. I don't know if he would get a fair trial in the U.S. I feel like at this point we're all just going, run, Snowden, run. And I don't know if there's anywhere you can run to in this world anymore. So I feel bad for him.
The Clapper thing, though, he was actually, as you're saying, he did blatantly lie. How come he's not suffering any kind of consequence? He lied to the Senate, right?
Yep.
And that's representatives of the people. Yep. He actually lied to the American people. Yep. Where he should actually, according to the law, have told the truth.
And that's so, frankly, why that's I think there's a legitimate argument that Snowden is a whistleblower, that he is, in fact, yes, telling us something we wouldn't have known otherwise, because our own government and the director of national intelligence is lying. So the only way to find this out is to for somebody like Snowden to step forward. You know, it's a tech show, and I understand people feel like this is politics, but there is a very strong angle of technology to this, because the real question is, are electronic communications in some way less privileged than snail mail? There's nobody asserting that the NSA is going through your mail, opening your mail. There are much better protections, frankly, against that than there are against them opening your email. In fact, many courts have held, and it's the position of the federal government, that after 6 months, it's not even your email anymore. It's abandoned.
It's absolutely the stuff we should be talking about on a tech show, right?
I think
the
so.
The environment that we have created as part of a society and as technologists and people working and covering this industry have created a new set of possibilities, a new set of rules. And as a result, we have to deal with a new set of values in order to live in the society that we're shaping. So we should be talking about this, and I expect we are going to be talking even more about it over the next decade as sort of data and all of this stuff becomes more and more available and accessible, and things like this are going to happen likely again and again. And we have to hold people's feet to the fire for doing stuff like this.
You may notice I've been watching carefully the news media and see what they call him, because they could call him a traitor. They could call him a whistleblower. They've decided, CNN and others have decided, and apparently this is because the AP style guy decided that the safest thing to call him is a leaker, which is which frankly is not a very...
Oh, boy.
Don't you love it when, as the media, and we rely on the AP style guide? I mean, seriously, like, just because we don't want to, because CNN doesn't want to make a judgment call, or the New York Times doesn't want to make a judgment call, like, man up and make an opinion one way or the other. You know, let's not.
Well, this is the unfortunate he said, she said dichotomy that media watchers like Jay Rosen have talked a lot about, that, well, all we have to do is get somebody from each side and straddle the fence, and we're objective. And that's not really quite the case, is it?
No.
Because some sides can be really, really wrong. And, and so straddling the fence is not helpful to the republic that we live in, I'm afraid.
Intelligent analysis goes a lot more, right?
Yeah.
But that's a very dangerous line, though. If you start asking the media to decide who is and who isn't a traitor.
True.
It's in this case, it might be, you know, the thing we want them to do, but there are a lot of cases where you want them to remain as objective as possible. So as a general rule,
I guess leaker is probably better than traitor or patriot. I mean,
or whistleblower.
We don't know either. Or whistleblower. Whistleblower is probably the most accurate. We don't know if he's a traitor or a patriot.
Yeah.
In any event, I don't want to belabor it, but since this is what everybody's watching today is his progress. He flew from Hong Kong to Russia and apparently is on his way to either Ecuador, Venezuela, or points unknown. If he's smart, it's points unknown.
I think it was confirmed he's going to Ecuador.
Ecuador, yeah.
Yeah.
I was looking, you know, Wikipedia, I said, gee, it's too bad there's nowhere you can go to find out who has extradition treaties with the U.S. Well, Wikipedia does, and pretty much everybody has an extradition treaty. So you can't get out of it.
North Korea, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, and it's ironic, isn't it? The places he's going are the places with far less freedom than we have.
Right. No, I mean, that is the irony, is that he has to go to those places in order to prevent extradition.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely a feeling that he was very careful in what he did in order to not put anyone in danger. And I if anything else, I have very little doubt about his sincerity. I guess that's something.
I think so too. Although you don't know. You can't.
Yeah, you never.
You're judging based on, you know, his body language and what you think. And I just don't know if we know. I do like Mike Elgin's article in Computer World on how to run your own NSA spy program. I got to get Mike on to talk about that. He said, you know, everybody's talking about PRISM. It's the federal government's discovered big data. The theory being just save everything and use technology to search for it. He says, you can do the same thing. He says, here's how to run your own. And, you know, I kind of like this. Your own private PRISM program. Save everything. Of course, Google now offers 15 gigs of free storage. And he suggests, I think this is an interesting idea. I used this for a while, and it did generate a lot of email. Use the Google Alerts service. So you could say any subject that you're interested in. He says, just have Gmail filter that in a folder. You don't have to put it in your inbox. File it away. You can search for it later. Do you guys use in your trade Google Alerts to keep track of stories?
Oh yeah,
I did before it stopped working.
Does it not work anymore?
It's funky, and there was a experience. I guess it was like in March, right around the same time they announced that they were killing Google Reader, that the Google Alerts so maybe like stopped working reliably too, and it's been buggy for a really long time. So it's hard to. It's not something I can rely on, but it's certainly useful for certain topics.
Better than nothing.
Yeah, totally. Well, the irony, of course, is they still let you subscribe to an RSS feed of a Google search, a Google alert summary. You just, you know.
There's just nothing in it.
There's just nothing in it and no place to read it.
No place to read it. But other than that, it's great.
But it's one of those things
that I think Google like used to have, you know, probably a dozen people on, and now.
Right. Nobody's working on it.
You know, nobody's really working on it or very just maintenance and not so much maintenance.
Mike also says there's a Google Scholar alerts. I don't know if that works any better, but that searches academic books, papers, and other resources for so you can use that to keep track of things in academic papers. Then he says turn on Google Voice so that everything is sent to your inbox. Metadata, good word. Metadata on all your calls, full data on your SMS chats, transcripts of recorded calls and voicemails, even the sound recording of your voicemails. Throw that all in a folder. Save all your Google Hangouts. He says then use If This Then That to suck metadata for just. Blow up that big data, harvest it all, save it to Google Drive, and then use algorithmic filters, just like the big boys at the NSA, to look for keywords.
So what he's saying is basically give Google the chance to be the NSA, right?
Yeah. Hey, are you afraid of Google still after this? Yeah. Oh, gee, they may serve me a targeted ads. They may tell a marketer what I'm interested in. Oh, horrors.
Yeah, no, I'm more concerned with are they giving my information freely to the government? That's honestly
Do you think that I really feel like when Facebook and Google and these other guys, you know, vigorously deny, we are not that they're honest in that respect. I don't think they need to, by the way. I think pretty conclusively figured out, and credit to Steve Gibson for the first to point this out, that all the government has to do is tap them upstream. Right where they join the internet, and Google has no complicity, no knowledge, but everything in and out of Google is stored by the NSA.
It's a great point.
So I frankly think Google is being honest when they say absolutely not. Sorry, I'm getting a text message from Google.
It would seem like all of these denials were so carefully crafted that they couldn't. I can't imagine they would lie on those. That would be a little bit too big.
I think what they want to do, and Google and Facebook and everybody is asking the government for permission to do this, is to say at least how many times they get requested for information by the federal government. And all
that's
they can
fair.
Say right now is lump all the law enforcement requests together, you know, and that's really kind of – in fact, Google even said that's doing people a disservice to say when Facebook says, well, we got 9 to 10,000 government requests last quarter. It's meaningless because how many of those are national security letters and how many of those are local law enforcement helping somebody find their iPhone? And there's a big difference.
I don't know that it's meaningless because the story at the time was the government is looking at everyone, you know, everyone's email almost directly in real time. And they said it's only a very small fraction of our users that we give out information about.
Right.
You know, when the story is the government is looking at all of your account, you know, a billion accounts, and you tell the story that they're actually only looking at, you know, it was 10,000 requests for what was it, 30,000 accounts. It does put things in context.
Yeah, and so here's the thesis, and we mentioned this last week, so apologies if you've heard it before, but I think it's important to note if you are the NSA or the FBI or any other secret three-letter agency, what you want to do is collect everything, regardless. And I think that that's probably what's happening. U.S. citizen, not U.S. citizen, international traffic, not international, collect it all. That's why they built a 5 zettabyte facility in Utah to store it. Then when you decide, oh, this person's a target of, a person of interest, then you go to Google and you say, hey, you know, who was using the internet at this time, at this date? We know that somebody was because we captured this downstream. Google has to tell you, and by the way, is forbidden from telling us. Now they've attached a name to that data, and they go through more data and find more stuff, build up a nice little packet of incriminating evidence to go after you with. So collecting everything just makes sense, even if you don't even look at it. You got it, in case you want it later. And I think that's probably what's going
right?
on. And you can search it.
Yeah, eventually, if you collect everything, the idea is you can search it, even if right now we don't even have enough
right.
mechanisms to search it all. But the hope is, well, search is catching up and catching up and catching up. Eventually,
right.
we can search it all and boom.
I think we can do it now. I mean, I think we're pretty good at this kind of stuff.
But playing devil's advocate for a second, wouldn't we want a super spy agency to collect everything they can collect? Maybe not, you know, the internal – well, I guess that's the point. The emails – that we don't want people to read, but that's their mandate.
Well, if your goal in life is perfect security, like I don't want anybody to do anything bad against us in the United States, this would be a good way to, you know, start to pursue that. And I don't just deny that, but I do fear that it also gives less benign governments, and we've seen this happen again and again, a tool that they can use to persecute people. And I fear that it'll be used that way too.
No, definitely. Certainly, but I mean, if it's only the public data, which is available,
but they think everything's public. The IRS thinks all your email is public, all your phone calls are public.
Yeah, that's yeah.
And I'm sure it's the same. By the way, I'm sure it's the same in France.
Well, I'm sure we would like to do that, but we don't have the technical know-how to do it.
Hey, we can help you.
Yeah,
I'm sorry, Christina, you were going to say something.
No, I was going to say, I mean, it's interesting if you look at like classic Fourth Amendment cases, you know, about search and seizure and the expectation of privacy, you know, when certain types of pornography were still illegal and they would come into someone's house under one guise and they would search into areas for something that they weren't even looking for. And they were able to find something in the context of that, you know, whether or not the question was whether or not can that be used, you know, to charge someone for a crime. And there have been various rulings on that on both sides. That's where I think it becomes scary, in that if you just happen to be caught into the crossfires of something and by going through your data, they find out, oh, you've, you know, committed this misdemeanor or this, you know, felony possession of drugs or, you know, something that might not even be the context of, you know, like terrorism or whatnot. I think people worry about that.
It's a fishing expedition.
Absolutely. And for me, the bigger concern would be for local governments and for state governments rather than even the federal government, you know, because it's only a matter of time before those agencies either get access, especially if you're talking about a big database and whatnot. And that's where you typically see a lot of the most the phishing expositions and people being persecuted for reasons that are not what they seem to be. You know, when people are kind of, you know, gone after because they didn't comply with something else. And I think that's, for me, the most worrying aspect. I mean, I understand the point of saying, well, why not just capture it all and have a database? And I think that that's fine if, as you said, your goal is to prevent bad things from happening. But by the same token, you know, how much information are you going to be having? What sort of profile are you going to be having on people? And at what point, as you said, our governments, not even maybe ours, but other countries going to start using that as a reason to go after people just because they're politically dissident or they're, you know, making trouble. And that's the really scary thing.
You can make a case that the IRS has gone after political dissidents already in the Tea Party stuff. I don't know about that, but certainly people are there's some evidence that the government has already done that many times. And, you know, under Nixon, under J. Edgar Hoover.
You know?
Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Well, without a doubt. I mean, I think that's the big thing, right, is that you look back through history and you can see the Nixon administration with the Hoover, you know, era of the FBI. You can see these clear violations of personal privacy, you know, looking back through, you know, the McCarthyism. And if all of that was able to happen without having those access to that much information, what could you do now that you have so much more personal information and so much personal correspondence that is taking place in avenues that are searchable? You know, earlier you said obviously it's easier for them to do it with email, digital mail, than postal mail. Well, part of that is because the process of actually going through and scanning and doing OCR and doing analysis of every single mailed letter would be a tremendous undertaking that would require so much more effort than it is to just, you know, tap into webmail servers and capture that data and then do, you know, kind of a Boolean search against or an algorithmic search against. So it's much easier for them now to get that data than it ever was before. And if you look at the cronyism and the things that our own government was able to do even in the last 50 years, I think that's why people have, I know that's why I'm concerned. And I'm typically not one of those like, oh, you know, my privacy is sacrosanct, but it's like, it makes you wonder.
Hey guys. Sorry.
Yes, there's a smoke detector going off, but it's not in our office.
Sorry.
It's Christina. She can't fix it. Just for those of you tuning in who are saying, is my smoke detector? She can't fix it. It's in her hallway, and union regulations prohibit her from getting on a very tippy ladder to fix it. So
the Teamsters will go nuts.
We're not going to let her do that.
If there's anybody on the Teamsters watching the show, please send someone to Christina.
Would you please put a battery in it? Thank you.
Come to Prospect Heights, please.
You know, I'm trying to be the devil's advocate here, and it's very difficult because I actually agree with everything you're saying. But
you can play the part of the devil's advocate, though. I usually
I'm trying to.
So I'll let you.
But
do that.
You know, taking an outsider's view, which, you know, as you said, I'm French. I'm wondering, do you guys feel like this is kind of a 9/11 hangover wearing off that we're seeing? Because these debates have been posed before, and no one seemed to be willing to listen. And they're very important questions that you're asking. Do you feel like the mood around these questions is changing?
That's a good point. These would not be asked. If this were October 1st, 2011, or 2001, rather, nobody would be asking this question. We'd all be going, yes, you got to do this.
I mean, it's always a peacetime versus wartime question, right? Yeah. During wartime, you hardly even ask these questions because it's like, you know, your existence is called into question. And,
right.
But in peacetime, it's absolutely critical to ask these questions. And that's why, I do, Patrick. I see that the tenor of these questions and the pitch being much higher than it would have been a decade ago. And I think people are, you know, regular people are a little uncomfortable with the possibilities of, you know, what's possible in terms of them being tracked and their data being accessed.
It also changes the conversation a little bit because, you know, with Microsoft scribbling and all of this stuff, Scribble's watching you, the Gmail man is watching you. It changes the conversation a little bit. We've been, you know, I've always said this. We've been paying attention to the wrong bad actors here. And if you're worried about Google, your ISP knows a lot more and is much more likely to share it with the FBI than Google
does. No, without a doubt. I mean, I was a freshman in college when 9/11 happened, and I remember I was in a public policy class, and we were talking about actually kind of this sort of information stuff. And I was pointing out I had friends who worked at Earthlink, and you know, this is before broadband was mainstream. And when someone would call in, they'd log into their account, and they could access everyone's email. They could go through a customer's email account and see everything that was happening. And that was kind of a wake-up call for me that, you know, even back then, your ISP had access to your entire mail server and you know, where you're browsing. And most people don't think about things in that context.
And most ISPs have much lower standards for what they're going to give the government.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. So, you know, that's always been, I think, you know, that's always been something that's been possible. But I think the difference maybe in now versus in 2001 is just the breadth of information that we have available. So even though I definitely agree that the tenor is different because it's wartime, peacetime, I also think that the amount of information that we have stored on these on the internet and the way that we use the internet has, you know, jumped 100 times versus where we were in 2001. That makes it different, too. You know, I mean, I think that changes the nature of the conversation kind of to the earlier point of why we should be talking about this on a technology show, because it is an implicit trade-off with doing all of this stuff online and with, you know, the internet and with technology becoming so much more advanced.
Well, here's a good example. You know, when this was in 2006, a whistleblower came forward and said, you know, the NSA has a secret room at AT&T in San Francisco. And they're capturing all the AT&T WorldNet traffic. But even then, they weren't saving. They couldn't save it all. It was too much traffic to save. So they would just filter on some keywords. Well, that's changed in 6 years. Now they can save it all. Now they have much better. We have much better big data analysis tools.
And data, you know, saving. We can, you know, obviously you can compress the stuff. You have more data.
Right.
And you know what? We've just scratched the surface on this. 5 years from now, it's going to be, not only are you going to be able to save it all instantaneously, it's going to be a lot more data.
Right.
It'll be hundreds of times more. But you'll be able to save it instantaneously. You'll be able to search it almost instantaneously. And, you know.
Pre-crime. Here it comes, baby. Yes. We'll know before you commit a crime what you're up to.
Minority Report is happening.
It is happening. It is happening. You know, here's the final piece and we'll move on. I have recommended in the past people use PGP or some other open source encryption to protect themselves, protect your privacy with the Onion router Tor. And we found out, if you read closely, that what the NSA was saying, they especially save stuff that is encrypted by PGP or Tor because, you know, we can't be sure where it came from. So we're just going to assume that it's international traffic. So I, in effect, have been just flagging everything I do for the last 10 years. Hey, me, capture my stuff. Let's hope they can't decrypt it. They can't yet, but maybe with quantum computing, and someday they'll be able to.
One last note that Berserker in the chat room pointed a good point out, that remember that Congress and the courts still do oversee the NSA. They don't get off scot-free to do whatever they want.
No, but we have to push Congress and the courts to do that.
Absolutely, yes.
Because they, in many cases, I think they've just put their hands up and said, yeah, we need this.
Congress is worried about being elected.
Yeah. Well, that's how you get them.
I think that the most important thing in this is what we were saying earlier. The people who are supposed to be overseeing this are being lied to by the people who they're overseeing. That's the core of the
issue. And they're doing nothing when they find this out.
Yeah.
In fact, Dianne Feinstein defended General Clapper. I mean, it's unbelievable. You know, instead of saying, he lied to us and we're not happy about that, she said, well, he maybe misunderstood the question. What?
Yeah, but you know that there's going to be senators and congressmen that are going to be more than happy to throw this guy under the bus soon. If the public turns against, you know, this idea, they will absolutely throw him under the bus. I mean, already his career is quite in jeopardy in the future. But I think that it's why we should talk about this. And I know we're at the end of at the segment, but if we can help put pressure on them to do the right thing here, that's a good thing.
I agree. And the best way to do it, go to EFF.org. They have great tools to help you. It's a big part of what they're up to. Call 1. What was that? Stop 323-NSA. They have a special phone number you can call. Basically, the best thing you can do is call your member of Congress or mail them, snail mail them, and let them know that you're a constituent. It's somebody you vote for, your senator or your member of the House, and say, you got to fight this. You got to stop this. This
email
is not
a black hole. Either call or send a snail mail. It sounds, you know, anachronistic, but there it is.
And kudos to the EFF, because once again, they're stepping up. And I donate money on a monthly basis to them. And I even gave them a big chunk when they were pursuing this podcast troll. I donated a chunk of money for that, too. Because they're good. Thank God they exist. We are talking about, yes, it's tech. In fact, coming up, we're going to talk about Instagram having video. Woo! But everything else seems so unimportant after all of this. But we're doing it with Christina Warren from Mashable Film Girl. Do you still use the Film Girl handle? I've been following you for years on Twitter.
I do, because everyone knows me that way.
You stuck with it. Was that because you were into film?
I was, yeah. I went to film school.
No kidding.
Actually, my academic background is in film, yeah.
Wow. Do you do anything with that?
No.
That's a shame.
Not anymore.
There's this thing called Kickstarter. Culture. Go there, say, I want money. I'm going to make a movie, and they'll give you money.
I've actually thought about doing that about software development.
Ooh.
She's a little busy writing, you know.
Yeah. Busy.
See how many pieces she writes a day?
You're talking to the wrong person about busy. So, no, seriously, what would you like to do? A software development, something like watch, you know, like Stephen Levy did with hackers, watch them at work. And
exactly, like a documentary.
Exactly. Love that. Would you do that?
Indie Game, the movie, I thought was really great.
And very good.
I thought, you know, I would love to see this, though, but about software developers and like mobile app developers or ISVs or enterprise software developers, just the whole process. Because I think as a creative work, it's not understood as being a creative work enough. And it really is everything that goes into designing, planning, and executing software.
Absolutely.
I think that'd be a great documentary.
It's art.
Subject.
Absolutely. Have you read Tracy Kidder's The Soul of a New Machine?
Yes.
That is one of my favorite of all time. And it's now pretty dated. It's ancient. He was at Digital Equipment in 1981.
Which, ironically, is my husband's one of his first jobs was
at DEC.
Right before compact bought him. And,
cool.
But reading that book is amazing. And it's...
That's what I'd like to see you do in a film. A film version of something... You know, there's other books. G. Pascal Zachary wrote a book called Showstoppers about the development of NT, where he was kind of an embedded reporter in the process. What a great time. Film Girl, do that.
Okay,
tell Lance you need a sabbatical and you're going to be making a movie. Okay? No,
it's a great idea, though. No, it's something I think about a lot.
Wouldn't it be fun?
Yeah.
We would plug the hell out of it. And out of your Kickstarter or your Indiegogo, so you could raise some money to do that. Also with us, Jason Heiner from Tech Republic, part of the CBS Interactive Network. Good to have you, Jason, from Lowell. And from Paris, France, is Patrick Beja, who does many French. Somebody asked me, what is a good French language podcast? I said, just follow Not Patrick on Twitter.
Thank you. I'm honored.
Well, you're the guy. I mentioned Cédric Ingrand, but Patrick Beja is the guy. The king of...
Well, Cédric doesn't... Yeah, he has a few shows as well.
Yeah, but...
I was going to say...
You're FrenchSpin.com.
Yes. Actually, I'm probably returning to FrenchSpin.com.
Are you?
After I... Yeah, I'm... We had another venture that didn't work out.
Yeah.
NoWatch.net. And now I'm thinking I'm probably going to be resurrecting FrenchSpin.com.
You killed NoWatch already.
Well, it is not dead, but it's not... doing super well.
Will you go back to, because you were doing some English language podcasts like the Phileas Club, will you go back to do those?
Yes. I don't think so.
No.
It was so much work.
Yeah.
Maybe somewhere down the line, but not right now. They were really super fun shows, but
great shows. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you.
Our show today brought to you by our friends at 99designs.com. We've just embarked on a really exciting new project with 99designs. I'll tell you all about it in time, and you'll be involved. But let me tell you what 99designs is. It's a place where designers get together with people who need taste. People who just, you know, we got ideas, we can do software, but taste is another thing. 99designs has over 230,000 designers waiting to work with you. So what you do is you create a contest on 99 Designs. You say, I need a t-shirt. That's what we did. I need better menus for my restaurant. I need a Facebook landing page for my business. I need a video game design. And you go to 99 Designs. Designers bid on your project. They show you spec art. You pick the one you want. You can even work back and forth. When you got the winner, you award them money. And a lot of money goes out to 99 Designs designers. There are currently over 1,700 open contests. Last month, they paid designers $1.7 million, total of $55 million to date. This is a very successful enterprise and a great way for you to get the designs you need, whether it's a logo, a web design. We're about to work with them on, I'm excited, our first app. They will do app design, too, and we'll tell you more about that, and we'll involve you when the time comes. It's not what you think. I think we want to do a Twit game. Crazy, right? We'll see. 99designs.com/twit. If you go there right now, you'll get a $99 power pack for free. That the power pack helps you get more attention. 99 Designs will bold highlight your design in their marketplace, letting designers know you're out there. And they'll even work with you. They'll consult with you to help you get the right design. Start right now as low as $199 for your own custom graphic. You can also, so either go to 99design.com/twit, as you see on the screen there, or you can call 800-513-1678. That's a number just for Twit listeners. 800-513-1678. Really, I really like these people. We're talking about technology, Instagram ads, video, 5 million videos uploaded in the first hour. The Instagram story is really great. So Kevin Systrom and company come up with a beautiful app. They were doing bourbon, which was kind of a flop. They flipped over to uploading beautiful images. Not much later, 6 months, something like that later, Facebook buys them for $1 million. And the reason it's obvious now is that the young people, the future of Facebook, were leaving Facebook in droves to use Instagram. They preferred it. Then along comes Vine. Instagram paid $1 billion. Facebook paid $1 billion for Instagram. The kids suddenly, they start using Vine. Oh, no. And this is, of course, Twitter owns Vine. They learned from, because they missed Instagram. They learned. They bought Vine. And then the Snapchat thing is also huge with the kids. Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg himself writes Poke and adds some Snapchat features. The kids go, pfft. And they're using Vine. They're using Snapchat. And Facebook's a little bit worried. So what do you do? Last week they added video to Instagram. I asked my kids. I have an 18 and a 21-year-old. The 18-year-olds immediately started posting stupid videos of him sleeping. The 21-year-old says, why are they putting videos? Instagram is about photography. And I kind of maybe agree with her. Is this a good move for Instagram? 5 million videos in the first day. Christina, you're a filmmaker.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's smart. I think that it's something that they definitely had to do because I don't know how much traction Vine was really taking. It's kind of hard to tell because...
Don't you think it's risky, though? Because you could alienate the Instagram base, couldn't you?
You could. I think they're doing it the right way. One, it's limited. It's limited to 15 seconds. Two, the way that it shows up in your feed, if you wanted to ignore and not tap and play the videos, you could
just scroll by
and,
it. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, you just see the cover, you know, image.
Right.
And I think that aspect of adding a filter to it is unique. I also think that the fact that they let you delete the little bits of clips you do makes it a little bit better than Vine in some instances. But video's hard, right? I mean, that's the thing, is that photography is one of those things where if you frame something even half decently and you put a decent filter on it, you can make a really bad-looking photo good.
That's what Instagram taught people. Photography takes no talent. Just put a nice filter on it.
but video is really not the same way.
No.
And video takes a lot, especially when you're talking about a limited amount of time. It takes a lot more planning, and it's much harder to do it right. And so honestly, you know, I think that they did it in the right way because I don't know how long it will be sticky, if that makes any sense. I feel like this could be a fad, whereas photography is kind of effervescent. And, you know, videos, people are either going to do something longer where they're going to want to use Vimeo or YouTube, or they're going to be doing very artistic, very cool, structured kind of, you know, stop motion or well-designed shorter clips. I kind of don't know long term, what the life cycle is on having a 15-second video clip. But I think that the way that they've done it is smart because it works similarly enough to an existing product, but you are within the Instagram ecosystem, which frankly is a lot better in a lot of ways than Vine, because I think that one of the reasons why Instagram was so successful is it started as its own social network first. And even after Facebook bought it, it has still remained in large part separate. You know, sure, you can see the posts that people do to your newsfeed and likes now kind of go both ways. But by and large, you know, you open up the Instagram app and that's where you consume all that material.
Right.
Because Vine launched after it had already been acquired by Twitter, I don't think that it ever had a chance to kind of grow its own social graph that's separate from Twitter. So it's not one of those things where, at least I know, I don't open up the Vine app and start looking for people's Vine.
It's too annoying. It's noisy. Yeah, audio is a real problem on these short videos. Because
I was going to say, that's my biggest complaint right now with Instagram for video is that there's not a way to mute the audio. Because most of the time, for what you want to do, it works better to have no sound at all.
And, they need to be able to turn off audio.
Absolutely. I mean, we've got one of our community producers, Jeremy. He is amazing. He does some of the most amazing Vine work you'll ever see. If you look at some of the stuff on Mashable's Vine account, he does the most amazing stop motion stuff. I mean, literally, he will plan things out and it will take him, you know, an hour to set up the perfect shot. And so he's already done some interesting Instagram things, but he's like a real artist. Like, he's doing incredible stuff. But
the thing most interesting on Vine was the animated stuff that people were able to do.
Exactly.
And with an immense amount of work.
Yes. I mean, that's what Jeremy does a ton of. And so I think it'll be interesting to see if there's able to be kind of a new kind of Instagram for video sort of art form. If there's a certain, you know, just like with Instagram posts, you know, you have the kind of the stereotypical types of Instagram posts, you know, outside the airplane, you know, of your coffee, of your shoes, you know, of the rain, of kind of a sideway look at the sky, you know, and I'm guilty of all of these. If you look at my Instagram feed, that's basically my
Instagram
feed.
Wasn't there a funny song?
Yeah, it was all the
cliched Instagram pictures. It's so embarrassing because you watch the song and you go, oh, yeah, I've done that
so
one.
Perfect. And then they did it to the tune of that Nickelback song photograph.
That's right. That's what it was.
Even better.
Yeah.
So good. I think that'll be interesting to see if this is able to take off and there's a kind of a Instagram for video sort of meme culture that takes off. But I'm not really sure. I mean, they had 5 million uploads the first day, but I'm kind of the opinion that because video is just so much harder, it might be one of those things that fizzles out. And if that's the case, then I almost feel like Facebook did this or Instagram did this in the right way and that it's not deviating from the core experience. And if it does become less popular, they won't have, you know, invested in this wholly separate product or anything.
I think the difference between like Vine and Vine and Instagram video is I think that Vine didn't really poison the well, right? Twitter is such a feed thing anyway. You get lots of stuff, you ignore 60% of it, you're looking for the little bit of good stuff that, you know, you're sort of interested in. Instagram's a little different in that it's for stylistic photos, although I'd argue and my wife, who is a photographer, would certainly say that filters ruin as many photos as they fix.
Because she's a pro and knows better. Everybody else goes, ooh, you antiqued that. It's gorgeous.
Yeah. I'm sort of over Instagram and have not been big on it. But everybody I know that uses Instagram that actually posted something about it on Twitter afterward, they said, that just ruined my feed. All these videos just ruined my feed. And so it's kind of like, that's why I say it sort of poisoned the well for Instagram, whereas I felt like that wasn't the case with Vine. The Vine is just sort of annoying and you kind
it's
of
It's so annoying because it's 6 seconds, which is just too short to do anything.
I disagree. I think Vine created something that's not a photo and not a video
either. I guess it's not a video.
It's sort of a kind of animated GIF, and video never really made it. Maybe Instagram is going to work. And you're right, Christina. They did make it exactly as it should be. But I really think Vine is something completely different. It's you can use it for videos and you can take small videos to show what you're doing, but all the editors pick here are something else. You know,
it's a unique to Vine experience. Yeah. I think you're right, Patrick. it is its own thing.
Well, no, I'm actually supportive of Vine, right? Vine, you can actually do kind of what Christina was talking about
earlier. I'm sorry, I hate Vine.
You can upload stuff like that.
And it loops. It loops. Well, I think Instagram did some things. Now, maybe that's just because I'm an old fart. So what I like, why I like Instagram better is it's 15 seconds, still has the same editing capability. It doesn't loop, which I find very annoying.
It has a beginning and an end. I don't understand this endless loop thing.
You're right. This is an animated GIF, isn't it? These are just animated GIFs. Yeah.
But the other, oh my God. What
I know. This, some of the stuff here, this is one of my favorites, though. I have to say, I really like this. And this could loop forever as far as I'm concerned. And we're looking at Vines. This is the editor's picks section.
See, you went on the story for Instagram videos. You ended up watching.
And I'm playing Vines. No, maybe you're right.
Yeah.
But the 15 second thing on Instagram is really interesting, right? It's I can't remember who, I'm sorry, but someone was saying it's the length of one of the formats of the TV ads.
It is for ads. It's for ads. It's very clear. Totally about ads.
So if you think people hate them now, wait until they see their TV ads showing up there.
Well, I mean, already see, you know, Tumblr has already been ruined by Yahoo, and I don't think Yahoo even owns them yet. But all of a sudden, I'm seeing...
It closed on Friday.
It closed?
Yeah. It closed.
Yeah, already?
Now. Yep.
I thought they... Geez, no regulatory or anything. They just went...
It was a cash deal, too, wasn't it? Yeah. I think that's part of
it. It was
well,
all cash.
But even before it closed, all of a sudden in my Tumblr feed, I'm seeing ads for TV shows, animated GIFs from bad hairspray ads and stuff. And I just really ruined it, as far as I'm concerned. And I think the same thing might happen to Instagram. I don't know. It's a risky
thing. Bad
video
ruins everything. That's
bad video is bad for everybody. But, I get a headache from Vine. To me, it's the audio. Why don't both of these guys, why don't they have no audio switch when you record these?
Well, you know what? The Vines we've been watching from your iPad work perfectly.
They're better without the audio.
Without audio, yeah.
Because the audio is so choppy because of the 6 seconds you have to really heavily edit. If I turn on the audio, you'll find these much more annoying. That's just annoying, period. I don't know what the hell that is. It's a bad dream the guy just had. But that is, you know, these are really unique in the sense that they have found a new medium. Who would have thought this up? So,
is it a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't know. Somebody pointed out our attention span is so bad that people are complaining that they've gone from 6 to 15 seconds. That's too long. That's so long. I can't pay attention for 15 seconds. It's very interesting to watch, and of course, the battle continues because. Twitter won't embed Facebook, the Instagram posts anymore in the Twitter cards, and now the video, and they're going back and forth. It's crazy.
The chat room is mentioning that Seismic actually did this a while ago, 7 seconds videos. They had similar service. I should point it out because it's Lloyd's. Yeah. It was Lloyd's.
And Text
company.
America did moblogging in 2001, but it's all about timing, isn't it? Poor Loic.
Totally.
Poor Loic saying,
I
invented that.
There was a video company that AOL bought called like 15 seconds or something like that. Like there have been a lot of these types
Fiddly.
Of things.
There's been a ton of these. 12second.com.
That's what it was. Yeah, 12second.
So few are good. I mean, the bottom line is so few of these are good or worth watching. And so, I don't know. Taking the photo.
They were also chatting services, right?
Different, right? Than doing good video. Good video is hard. I mean, being visual interestingness is hard. And so, I don't know. I think stop motion and things like that, maybe as the tools get better and people become better at short video, that's sort of the thing that's not out there. Video creation tools that can make short videos interesting and worth watching and maybe even contribute something is the missing link.
Flickr had 30-second videos, taxi cabs tell me in the chat room.
Yeah.
But I think all of it is about getting the attention of young people, right? Because that's really where the battle's happening here. Isn't it? What do we get the kids? How do we get the kids to use it? But the problem is the kids are fickle. They went from MySpace to Facebook to Instagram to Vine to Snapchat. They're fickle. They'll use whatever other kids are using.
And they're going to use what their parents aren't using. They're
right.
Going, you know, because,
that's what went wrong with Facebook, mom and dad.
Well, totally. And frankly, MySpace at that point, too. I mean, anytime anything becomes too popular, I remember what it was like to be, you know, I joined ICQ. My number started with a one, so I was like one of the very first, part of the first group of ICQ users. And when that became kind of, you know, inundated with tons of people, you know, you moved to other chat services. And I was a LiveJournal user, and I had a bunch of other things. But you don't want to be, you want to be amongst your peers. You don't want to be in an environment where everybody knows about it, because that doesn't, that's when you're young, that's not what you want to do. That's why, right, Snapchat, I think, is so ingenious, and why people wouldn't want to use Poke.
Right.
So I think the key, though, I mean, Facebook buying Instagram was so smart because they were basically understanding that Instagram had a chance to be a real disruptor to Facebook. So, you know, create your own disruptor, create your own product that's going to kill your other one rather than letting some other service come in and do it. And that's just going to be the challenge, I think, moving forward, is for these companies to create the piece of technology or the service that is going to put the other one out of business. And unfortunately, that's a hard thing to kind of determine, because it's fickle based on the users, based on their ages, based on the demographics. So I don't know.
You're around 30, right, Christina?
Yeah, I'm 30. Yeah.
30. So, you grew up in the internet era. What do you remember the first thing you used to communicate with your friends?
Yeah. I used ICQ.
ICQ,
used,
of course.
ICQ, yeah. I used ICQ and 1-845-645. That was my user number.
Still remember it.
I still remember it. And I used, I had Juno for email.
Juno, yeah, the free internet,
When AOL Instant Messenger became, you didn't have to have an AOL account when it opened up to everybody. And I think that was in 97.
Okay.
That became huge.
As a teenager, you were not on the phone with your friends.
No,
wasn't happening yet. You were instant messaging.
Wasn't happening yet. No, we were instant messaging. Yeah. Actually, how it usually worked is that we were on the phone with three-way, and then IMing people on the dedicated computer, you know, line. It was basically how it usually worked.
I remember going upstairs, and my daughter, who's younger than you, but same kind of thing. She's doing her homework. She's got three people on the line in a party call. She's got instant messenger going, and there's music playing.
Yes.
And I thought, what the hell?
And then we all got pagers, and so we would start to kind of
text each other using Blackberries?
No. This was before that. Just like pagers. Regular pagers, but you would just put in, you know, you would put in letters. There was a way you could kind of, you know, write to people, almost using
game it. It was like a texting thing. Yeah.
Wow.
Totally. And then once we all got cell phones, you know, but of course minutes were expensive. But text messaging didn't really start until I was in college.
Right.
But we were all over IM.
It was early 2000s that people started text messaging.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it really wasn't you, because you couldn't go cross service. You had to use that weird number pad. You type AAA, BBB, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah. It's fun to see how quickly, though, this has changed and how rapidly it changes. And there are people, and I know a lot of them, who say, oh, Facebook's won. You know, they got a billion users, they won.
Yeah.
Google's won. No. No. Nobody wins.
I don't think, of course, they're not, you know, what is define winning? Right, they're not going to be here until the end of time, but certainly they're safe for a little while. I think that's reasonable to think, right?
Yeah, just like ICQ.
Well,
what could
possibly
go wrong? No one.
Totally.
BlackBerry Messenger is so huge.
No, but come on. I mean, 1 billion people. Everyone is on there. Everyone can quit from 1 minute to the next. But there is something about the social network. There is a critical mass.
Yes, and the network effect. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
And yes, it could disappear. It could, wane over time. But it's going to take a while. It's not like tomorrow.
So is it slowing down, do you think?
Certainly it is slowing down. Of course. Yeah. And of course, the kids, the youngsters, are interested in other things. But
that's what I see. Because, I love watching my kids. And now they're too old, I'm going to have to find some new kids. Because you watch them and they have no allegiance. Right? Brand means nothing to them. They have no allegiance. They just do what other kids do. And a kid finds Vine and everybody starts using Vine. Within 3 weeks, the whole school is using Vine. It's just fascinating to watch these. They're like schools of fish. They go,
They going to go to Facebook after they're done with their experimental?
No. Facebook's done for these kids.
Is it?
Yeah. Almost everybody I interact with on Facebook is older than me.
Yeah, Facebook's done for kids.
Almost.
Yeah. And well, that's what I mean. I Facebook's in more trouble Facebook. Than people understand.
Yeah. But I mean, I agree with you for the younger users, but do you think that because that Facebook has become ubiquitous enough that even if it's, I mean, I still think that they have to find a way to create, you know, products that will resonate with younger users and maybe even brand it differently or something to have them use the service. But do you think it's become ubiquitous enough with older people and with, you know, the vast majority of internet users that you feel forced to use it. It's kind of, you know, what Yahoo was for a while or even AOL. Yeah,
Windows XP of social networks.
That may be, right, but remember right. that the revenue comes from advertisers who, for reasons I don't fully understand as an old man, have a real passion for the 18 to 25-year-old. They want to reach that group. They can't reach them through television.
They have disposable income. They have disposable income. So the people, even me, I've aged out of that area. But yeah, they want to go after people.
I've aged out of 25 to 54. I'm really, I mean.
although I'm dual income, no kids. So I'm
you're good. You're a dink.
You're a dink. That's pretty good.
Yeah, but exactly. So we're like.
It's disposable income and they form their taste.
I just say, I have a ton of freaking disposable income here. But nobody's advertising except for Viagra and Depends. Nobody's trying to reach me. Speaking of which, we're going to take a break because I got to go to the bathroom. We got a dink here, and her name is Christina Warren from Mashable. We've got a Frenchman, Patrick Bejean, not Patrick, on Twitter. And from Tech Republic, the great Jason Heiner. We're talking about tech. We'll have more in just a bit. But first, let's find out what's coming up on the week ahead. Tom Merritt.
Hey, thanks, Leo. Here's a look at some of the stories we'll be keeping an eye on in the week ahead on Tech News Today. Monday, June 24th, Aereo supposed to launch in Atlanta. Haven't heard much about this. We'll see. Tuesday, June 25th, Project X Zone crosses over to America. The $99 Ouya is supposed to go on retail sale. Wednesday, June 26th, the HTC One Google Edition announced that Google I.O. will launch for $599. Also, Microsoft Build 2013 kicks off at the Moscone Center in San Francisco. Digg's Google Reader replacement beta is scheduled to open. Google will also offer the unlocked Samsung Galaxy S4 with stock Android for $649. And still on June 26th, Mobile Asia Expo starts, and Sony's hinting it will have a new smartwatch to announce there. Thursday, June 27th, Sony again says it will fix the unusable PlayStation 3 software with a patch. Amazon will begin selling Kindle tablets and e-readers online in India. The NVIDIA Shield is scheduled to launch. Friday, June 28th, BlackBerry announces their earnings, and Nintendo of America begins retiring several of those Wii online services. And Sunday, June 30th, Sprint will have shut down all of the Nextel iDEN network, and that will be the end of that. That's a look at the week ahead. Ooh, lots going on next week. Back to you, Leo.
Previously on Twit. Before you buy.
This week at the Worldwide Developers Conference announced one new computer, a new MacBook Air. Of course, I had to order it right away. This is, you know, the Cadillac, the class act of thin and light notebooks, and remains so.
Know-how.
So I've got my Galaxy S3 in hand, and I'm going to use ROM Manager Premium to install a new ROM on this device. And now my phone is going back to its TouchWiz goodness, as you see the Samsung logo.
This week in Enterprise Tech.
There was another article off CDNet explaining that people got it wrong, right? These companies are not, quote, on board.
Ultimately, they lost, and so their data started being collected by the NSA.
iPad Today. This is the second largest school district in the country.
In the country.
640,000 students. Every one of them eventually will get an iPad.
That's right.
K-12.
Yeah.
Twit. Take it to the bank.
General Burnside, double barrel bourbon in Oregon Oak. Oh, I'm sorry. Are we back? Thank you. Appreciate it. That's what you missed. If you missed a minute on Twit, you got to watch all week long all sorts of great stuff. Did you get the elephant toothpaste in there? That wasn't in the, was that last week? Was that last week or the week before?
I guess we didn't get that in there.
You missed the elephant toothpaste. That was this week.
Yep.
That's like the thing that, the big thing that happened this week.
Yeah, we missed E3 last week too.
Highlights. What good are they?
Don't know. Somebody, you really need to watch all of Twit, not just
yeah. The highlights not going to do it for you. You know, we're doing a new thing, and Chad's been very good about this on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit. We try to pick not like a short highlight, but like a good moment from each show so you could see, get a sense of what the shows are about, and that kind of thing. And so if you go to youtube.com/twit, you could see that. And, of course, each show has its own channel on YouTube, which we now, I think, have figured out. We don't get as many blocked as we used to,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Or if we get just as many,
we take them down.
We put them back.
Put them back.
Just as fast.
All right.
Are you going to drink that bourbon now?
I'm trying to open it.
Okay.
If I can open it. So Facebook, I think, has an issue with these 18 to 25-year-olds. The reason they want young people is not merely disposable income, but they get you at 18, they got you for life. That's a lot longer.
Yes.
They get me for life. What do they got? 5 years and it's done. So there is a reason to go after these younger people. Facebook wanted to put video ads, speaking of Instagram, but it looks like even though they've been shopping these around to agencies, the asking price for a day-long video ad on Facebook was in the seven figures. And they were selling demographics. Things like, you want 18 to 34-year-old women? We can do that. But it looks like it's going to be delayed. Oh, I'm so disappointed. The launch has been pushed back to early fall, according to Advertising Age, Ad Age. Not sure why. I think perhaps there's some nervousness at Facebook's part that they don't really know how people are going to react to this. $1 million. They were asking as much as $2.4 million for an ad that be seen by all U.S.-based Facebook users. So, I mean, we're talking Super Bowl money for this. The question is how they'll work. Audio won't be activated unless a user clicks on the 15-second ad. At which point it will restart and spread like a cancer over the right and left-hand rails of the page. I added the like a cancer. That wasn't in that age. So the video will appear, if you're targeted, in your news feed up to 3 times on the day they're slotted. So you go and you come back. It's still there. And it plays silently. Then it spreads from the news feed. Wow.
People hate this kind of stuff. I mean, working That's for annoying. A site where we have we do lots of ads, right? And we charge a lot for takeovers and all of that for the reason that we know a lot of people hate them and they're going to sort of click off.
But you still do them.
But we still offer them, but we charge a lot because, you know, you're infringing on people's time in order to offer it.
Hey, so, I am not going to ever knock anybody. We do ads. We do big ads. We take over the takeover. We stop the whole show and start doing an ad, which I'm about to do in a minute. but you got to pay for this stuff, right? You either charge people directly or you put ads in.
Yep. And you knew Facebook was going to have to do this, that they've been cultivating users for a long time and under advertising to them to a degree. And you knew this stuff was coming. Mm-hmm. And so nobody could be surprised by it. Nobody should be. But they are going to be put out by it. Users always are. Everybody's time is valuable and attention is very valuable.
Never before in video, seen before video of Steve Jobs in 1994. I need the flash player. So I got the new MacBook Air and I'm really doing everything I can not to install flash on this MacBook Air. Let me turn on the HTML5 on YouTube and see if I can play it then. Jim Dalrymple of The Loop published this, I think.
So that's the one where he says that basically... Oh, sorry, you have it up. Okay.
Here it goes. From an interview he made while he was at Next in 1994. And this is from the Silicon Valley Historical Society.
All the work that I have done, it is a very strange business and a very strange endeavor of life. All the work that I have done in my life will be obsolete by the time I'm, 50. Apple II is obsolete now. Apple I's were obsolete many years ago. The Macintosh is on the verge of becoming obsolete in the next few years.
Oh, God. It's heaven for Fend.
This is a field where one does not write a Principia which holds up for 200 years. This is not a field where one paints a painting that will be looked at for centuries or builds a church that will be admired and, looked at in astonishment for centuries. No. This is a field where one does one's work, and in 10 years it's obsolete. and really will not be usable within 10 or 20 years. I mean, you can't go back and use an Apple One because there's no software for it. In another 10 years or so, you won't be able to use an Apple II. You won't even be able to fire it up and see what it was like. So it's sort of like sediment of rocks. I mean, you're building up a mountain, and you get to contribute your little layer of sedimentary rock to make the mountain that much higher. But no one on the surface will, unless they have X-ray vision, will see your sediment. They'll stand on it. It'll be appreciated by that rare geologist. But no, it's not like the Renaissance at all. It's very different.
You feel a little sadness there too, don't you? Like he knows that he's building a legacy, but a legacy that won't last forever.
Principia is an Isaac Newton reference, by the way.
Wow, I missed that. That's wow.
You know, laws that are going to be that people are going to be talking about for generations that are going to Great reference, by the way.
He was certainly right in what he was saying at that point in his career. I think now he will remain at least in. He has this image of the greatest second act of entrepreneurship history in America or the world. He was probably at a time at Next where he felt maybe I've done what I could do and that's going to be forgotten. Now he's come back and done iTunes and the iPhone and iPad, obviously. So he might have had a different. A few different things to say if we redid the interview now.
I think that's right, Patrick. I think, and even if you look at his comments right after he joined Apple, that's pretty consistent with things that he was still saying. I mean, he still obviously had the ambition to do big things, but he was kind of wondering if it was still over for Apple or what else there was to do. And both the internet and then sort of post-PC device regenerated, I think, the possibilities. And obviously some of the things that they did helped that, obviously.
Yeah, but he's still... Go ahead.
I was going to say, right after he passed away, John Lasseter was on Charlie Rose, and they were talking about him, and Charlie Rose mentioned that about maybe 12 months before he rejoined Apple, or about this time he was doing press for Toy Story, he was talking to Charlie and basically was kind of lamenting the fact that he couldn't go back in and save Apple and kind of correct the ship. And it seemed to be that's what Robert X. Cringely said, too, in the lost interview of Steve Jobs from the unedited company used for trying of the Nerds, was that he had this sense that, if I knew what I know now, if I could go back and do it over again, things would be different. But I do get the sense that at least probably when that video was, the video that we just played was done and pre-end of 96, he probably had figured my moment of real, impact is over and I'm not going to have a chance again. And then, of course, that changed, fortuitous for everyone, but that changed. But I get the sense that he very much was kind of the opinion that no matter what he might do and what impact however he might be seen in the guise of history was past. Obviously it wasn't.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I mean, we remember Thomas Edison, although most of his stuff is out of date, I guess. But it's not like, it's ironic because whose stuff will last? Pixar's stuff, John Lasseter's stuff will last a lot longer than an Apple II or a Macintosh. So,
but do you think that we would look back as fondly on Apple? Like, let's say that he hadn't come back, that the what's his face,
Gil Amelio,
the one we try to forget, he who shall not be named.
Gil Amelio, whose book I read last year that he wrote after he was fired from Apple,
in which he said, "I did it all."
Oh yeah,
Jobs is just following after everything I invented.
Exactly, it was one of the best books I've ever read because it was so completely so hilarious. Recommended to anyone, like 500 Days at the Fire or something like that. Like it's fabulous. You get it off of Amazon for like $2. So good,
and worth it.
It's so funny, if Emilio had not been fired and if Steve Jobs hadn't come back and Emilio had, run it into the ground, would we look back, do you think, today at Apple and see it with these rose-colored glasses? Or would it be something like Palm?
Would be like Atari. Absolutely.
Or NEC.
Amiga is a great example. Commodore. Where we would look back and we would think, Yeah, that was great. But, like, you know, history is won by the victors, right? And part of the reason we look back on Edison and he won is because, you know, he won. You know, Tesla might have had better technology, but Edison won.
That's a good point.
And GE's still around, so right?
So if we had, if he hadn't been able to come back and have that second act, I do think that maybe he was onto something. I mean, I think Pixar would have lasted him and would have given him a legacy. But, you know, Next and Apple, if he hadn't come back and if Apple hadn't been able to be righted, I do think that we probably would be looking back at it now in the sense that, oh, it had potential, but we wouldn't be, you know, creating this mythology around it. And it wouldn't have, you know, the onus of being, you know, the first, you know, major, you know, mainstream, you know, graphical user interface and the first real personal computer. I think that we would probably
That's a good point.
You know?
He popularized that, didn't he? That's a very good
he
point.
He did.
Yeah.
He did. You know, he did. Yep. He, as he said when he introduced the iPhone, he revolutionized a few things. The first one was the Mac, the computer with the Mac, and then you had iTunes, which revolutionized the music industry, and the iPhone and the iPad, of course. But I think there's another aspect of the second period of Steve Jobs, which makes it a lot more impactful than it had been until then. And it's the internet, in the sense that we all could see the keynotes where he has a quality. You know, the reality distortion field was spread over so many more people who could experience the bask in the glorious light of Steve Jobs and be influenced by his weird charisma. I think that also plays a role because everyone knows and remembers this now, where back in at the time of the Mac, it was just the people who were in the room with him. So that might also have played a role.
I think that's fair.
All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I'll show you a different side of Steve Jobs. The trailer from the Ashton Kutcher movie. Compare and contrast, ladies and gentlemen. But first, a word from Stamps.com. Stamps.com is a place to go if you need postage. Not the post office. No! Why go to the post office when you could print all the postage you need any time of the day or night, 24/7, without a trip to the post office? It's Stamps.com. Stamps.com, by the way, is not a postage meter. I think sometimes people think, oh, yeah, I know about that. No. In fact, a postage meter costs a whole heck of a lot more and is not nearly as convenient as Stamps.com. Did you know? I didn't know this. Postage meter ink is 100 times more expensive than inkjet ink, which is already ridiculously priced. Bye-bye, postage meter. You got Stamps.com, your computer, your printer. Whatever you've already got, you could print the postage. You could print right on envelopes with your logo, the return address. Stamps.com works with any address book, QuickBooks, to put the recipient's address in automatically, so no typing for you. In fact, with automatic address verification, you can use cost codes to track postage spending by customer, by department. You can get discounts you don't get at the post office, even discounted package insurance, all in one click. All the forms are filled out for certified mail return receipt. It'll actually send an email to your recipient with the tracking number automatically. International customs forms automatically filled out. It really is easy. I want you to visit Stamps.com right now. You'll see an $80 no-risk trial. You may be tempted if you're a small business. No. Click that microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Enter the offer code TWIT. That $80 bonus value, no-risk trial, is now a $110 offer, $55 worth of free postage you can use over the first few months of your account. You get that USB scale, that beautiful scale. You get a $5 activities kit, including, you know, stamps you could print on if you want to, like, put stamps on an envelope. And, of course, a month of Stamps.com. It is the pro tip for anybody who does a lot of mailing. Stamps.com. Try it today. Use the offer code TWIT for that special $110 no-risk trial offer. So the first full trailer. Now remember, this was the movie. There's two Jobs movies coming.
This is the fake one.
This is the bad one.
This is the fake one. This is not the real one. People get it. People have yelled at me on Twitter and they've said, no. How can you say what's real, what's fake? I'm like, one
watch.
Is sanctioned by.
Just exactly. Watch. You tell
one
me what's.
Yes, seriously. One is written by Aaron Sorkin and produced by Scott Rudin, and one is this.
Not that that's going to be more accurate, but this is.
No, but it's the real one.
This is a howler. Here's a. Ashton Kutcher as Steve Jobs.
Steve, it takes guts to drop out like you did.
Higher education comes at the expense of experience.
Boss,
What are you working on?
It's a computer terminal that hooks up to the TV from the display.
I do like this one.
Steve?
Wow.
It only takes one person.
These are state of the art. Nobody's making anything like this.
Start a revolution.
All right. Okay.
Welcome to Apple Computer.
Is this everything?
Startup.
I think we should start with around 90 grand.
Could you repeat that?
If you'll have me aboard. Trust me on my
INDEPE. Inspired by true events. Not actual true events. I don't know. I might want to see this.
We got to make the those things unforgettable.
Typeface isn't a pressing issue. Get out.
That I like too. I think that's awesome.
Start a war with IBM.
Steve's been doing the impossible ever since he was in a garage.
I'm trying to build an Apple, and they're taking it away from me?
If you keep heading down this path, I will not protect you.
It's a blatant ripoff.
I'm going to sue you for every cent.
You are your own worst enemy.
The board is unanimous. Steve will no longer be involved in this company.
10 years after Steve Jobs' departure, the future of Apple Computer is in jeopardy.
In life, you only get to do so many things.
We're going to make Apple cool again.
So I guess it brings him from the garage right up to the iMac, his return.
Yeah, they lied about their scope of it. They were originally saying, it was just going to be about his visions on life and this and that. And then they were like, no, we can totally make this a biopic.
It's called Jobs, just Jobs.
We're gonna do this thing. You know those like books that they're like the reductionist
that
books
so
that you see from...
computers.
I just hate Woz. I know that guy's a good actor. I liked him in Lost, but he's not Woz.
No, he's not.
It's not him. Is it the guy from Lost?
Isn't it?
I don't know.
Some fat guy with a beard. Well. They all look the same.
No, it's not the guy from Lost. It's the guy from Love and Other Drugs. That Jake Gyllenhaal movie.
I like him too, but he's not Woz.
No, he's not.
Not even close.
Does anyone else love that they're using the music from the Windows 8 ads?
Is it really?
Yes.
That's kind of tone deaf.
Well, this whole production company is tone deaf. Can I go on a rant real quick about why I... All right. So
why do you hate this movie, Christina Warren?
The reason I hate this movie is because, A, I can tell you already it's probably going to be terrible. Because anytime it's been delayed, it got picked up at Sundance, I realize, but anytime you delay a film and you push it back and it's not going from like the dead zone release period to something more advantageous, it's because you're not going to be able to sell it that well. But beyond that, when they were shooting this film, the production company reached out to us and offered us the opportunity, and they did this for some other reporters too, and some people took them up on it and said, you could be an extra on the film if you come out here and write a story about it, and the only way we'll get it, but we won't give you any access to the actors, the director, the crew, but you can be an extra, and then you need to write a story about this. So first of all, the way that set visits always work is that and I've been a film journalist before, is that you actually get access to be able to talk to crew members, cast members, see production. You are not bribed to write an article by being an extra, and you are certainly not told that you can't have any interaction with the cast or crew. And so to me, that was the impetus of that was going, okay, well, this entire production is really, really slimy if they're trying to, get press this way and not to go the way that it's always done, but try to basically bribe people into writing stories by saying, but you can't interview anybody who's part of it, and we're not going to give you any exclusives. So obviously we said no on that.
It is a pretty amateur movie.
Yeah. It's at best it'll be a TV movie quality at best.
Yeah.
I mean, look, Ashton looks a lot like Steve Jobs. That's great.
That's about it, right? They got a guy who looks like Steve Jobs.
It's like there's a real movie from Oscar winners like being produced.
Wozniak had two words for it. He said atrocious and awful. Not for the trailer. He read the script. He said awful and atrocious.
When you look at it, what I was saying was the, those books you see that are like for young adults of biographies,
Benjamin
Franklin, and all. They take these things and they reduce them to these platitudes, right? They take something really complicated that happened, like, you know, the founding of the Constitution, right? And they reduce it to a platitude. And that's, I feel like this whole movie, like all the dialogue that we see is like a sort of a platitude that you would reduce it to like a 10 to 12 year old on what the, you know, founding of Apple Computer and the life of Steve Jobs meant. You know, that's what this whole thing sounds like, you know, every bit of it.
Yeah.
But you think, but I don't, sorry.
Movie-licious man. You do movie stuff too. So yeah, we'll let you
talk. Yeah,
I did. Actually, I saw The Bling Ring and hated it. I was very disappointed.
Oh, I love Sofia Coppola.
I liked it.
I love Sofia Coppola, but
I want to show you. This is the this is the Steve Jobs I know.
Four is in six seasons.
Steve, on your knees and
that's Steve on. I mean, that's Woz. I should say that's the Woz I know, doing the fish or the worm on the Dancing with the Stars.
But you know, the I love Sorkin and I adore The West Wing. But
he botched Facebook.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think the movie was good, but you can't really rely on him for historical accuracy.
I don't think he likes technology. I think that's part of the problem with Aaron Sorkin. He hates computers.
Yeah, he does.
I'm not sure we're going to get a very accurate depiction of Steve Jobs' life with his movie.
Right.
And quite frankly, as you're saying, Jason, the only way to get out of the platitudes is probably to read, you know, two or three or four books about the guy to understand exactly what he was like. So,
do you guys think the Isaacson book was good?
I liked it.
Yeah,
there were good things in it. I think it's a good start. I think people will launch off of that and do better work. Historians on Steve Jobs, you know, the thing is he was doing a lot, right? He was trying to cover a lot in that. Mm-hmm. And so I think people will do better work historically going back by delving into certain pieces of it, right? Like the whole iTunes entertainment thing. Somebody should write, you can write a book about that. That was a thing. You can write their books, and there have been a number of good books, maybe not a definitive one yet, on the early sort of Steve Jobs' first stint at Apple. So I think Isaacson, there's some gaps, there's some lack of analysis on some important stuff. But I think it's a solid first start. And Isaacson, you can tell that he had to do this and he was doing it quickly and to try to get it out, right? He was kind of racing against time. Cause if you look at his books that he did on Franklin, on Einstein, he did the kind of analysis that sort of good historians do and biographers. And he talks about in the interviews, he talked about the fact that the great thing with Steve's life is like these things were happening. He was involved when Steve had that last interview with or that last meeting with people at Apple. He said he called him. That was the last call that he had, the last interview. Steve Jobs called him literally right after and told him what happened and his perspective on it. And the great thing, he said, he talked to four other people that were in that room and got their perspective on it. And they said completely different things. Like they all came away. And he said, I couldn't do that. Going back to Einstein, I couldn't talk about, you know, what, you know, after he sent the letter to Roosevelt and talked to him, I could never get that kind of perspective. So I think that's the best stuff in the book is the stuff at the very end where Isaacson had a unique perspective on what was there. And I think other historians will build on that work.
My big request is that Walter Isaacson release the tapes of the many hours of interviews he did with Jobs. Because Isaacson himself was... You know, he was a little new to this. He was a little green. He was obviously not very tech savvy. He made some dumb mistakes. But the raw materials need to be released to historians. And then, you know, that's a big part of it is that he got access when nobody else did.
Yeah, and he's a true historian. And so I have to think that he already has plans for his notes and his tapes and all of that to go into an archives at some point in time. I have to think that that was part of the agreement with Jobs was him saying, look, when I'm done with this or when I die or whatever the time is, time frame, this stuff is going to be donated to the Library of Congress, to, you know, some library, you know, New York Library.
It's really valuable stuff, and it shouldn't go with Walter.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with Jason. I think that the biggest asset was that he had all of that access to him, and if those tapes or something could be turned over, then we would probably be able to wind up with a much more in-depth book that's much more nuanced.
Yeah. We don't know much about what Apple's going to do with the new iPhone. Some rumored pictures. Mac Rumors says they got photos of what are the rear shell of the 5S or whatever Apple decides to call the September version of the iPhone 5. Looks a lot like the old iPhone. In fact, I don't think you can really tell much from these pictures at all. A redesigned rear shell, according to Mac Rumors, making room for a larger dual LED flash cutout. Okay. Maybe a higher resolution camera. Apple's been experimenting, apparently, with 12 and 13 megapixel cameras. A night shooting mode, perhaps. I guess we're just going to have to wait and see. Apple has really done a much better job. Tim Cook last year at All Things D said, we're going to double down on secrecy. And I think the fact that we knew absolutely nothing about what Apple was going to announce at WWDC shows that he has done that. And we have nothing on the next iPhone. Anybody? Thoughts? NFC? Fingerprint technology?
Yeah, there was this fingerprinting rumor thing that was floating around. I've been really wondering. I'm still using an iPhone. I think I'm going to keep using an iPhone. I just like the simplicity. But I'm really wondering what they could do to make it become a super compelling device for everyone, like to give it a leg up. And I can't imagine what they could add to the iPhone that would make it better than the alternative. I can't imagine what could interest me in that way. So I'm not sure.
I mean, mobile payments is big, right? We're still sort of waiting for its moment. I don't know that the next iPhone is going to be it. I don't think they want to go with NFC. NFC is a battery. It still has battery problems. I think they want to try to do it with Bluetooth 4.0 or something. It's one of these. It's an iTunes kind of situation as well, right? There's a lot of competing interests, and trying to get everybody on board on a standard or at least a method of working together is tough. If anybody can do it, Apple is certainly positioned to be able to do it. I think it's one of the reasons that I think they are going to do it and they have plans to do it is they brag all of these keynotes. They talk about how many credit cards they have, right?
Right.
On file.
Right.
That's a billion or something. Yeah.
Yeah. They are telegraphing every time that we're working on online payments. Every time they say that, know that they're telling you we're working on the world's greatest, electronic payment system.
Or just stay out of our way because one of these days we might do that.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will talk about John McAfee or McAfee. I now at least know how to pronounce his name, if very little else. We can also talk about the big story. We might have buried the lead. They're calling it the Xbox 180. Microsoft backs down on everything. But first, a word from Squarespace, the secret behind your next website. Perhaps, I hope so. Squarespace is a great place to go, not only for great hosting, because that is part of their business. They give you fabulous hosting, never go down hosting, but they also have the best content management system anywhere. Oh, look, new homepage, create your own space, websites, domains, commerce, mobile, 24/7 support. Website design is the least of what they do, but they do offer incredible, beautiful designs, but you can completely customize them. You can make them your own. They've got designers constantly working. Their award-winning design team is always adding new features, new design templates. They've got the events collection, just added that for people who have schedule updates like store sales events, band tour dates, podcast release. They have a new full bleed template. We've shown that now, the momentum. Isn't that beautiful? I love that. If you're a photographer, designer, artist, Squarespace is great for you because each Squarespace site is elegant and beautiful, and you can customize it easily to make it look all your own. Literally, create your own space. Mobile also, responsive designs. Go ahead.
It's also adaptive. Squarespace 6 is completely adaptive on all devices. So
small screen, big screen, it's going to look gorgeous. And I don't know of anybody who's doing a store like that. And that's one of the neat things. You get a mobile store as part of the deal when you get the Squarespace Commerce Package. Look at the pricing because That's the other thing that's pretty remarkable. $16 for their most popular plan, the unlimited plan. That's if you buy an annual package. You can go $20 a month to month. But that gets you unlimited bandwidth, so you never get a bandwidth bill. I don't know of anybody doing that. Unlimited pages, unlimited galleries, blogs, contributors. You could do a newspaper site for $16 a month with hundreds of writers. Unlimited storage, too. The mobile is all part of it. Every template is automatically resizes to fit any size screen. So you don't have a separate mobile site. It just looks great on any size screen. If you buy the annual plan, you'll get the custom domain registration. They'll hook it all up for you. So you can have the site of your dreams. And at $8, $24 a month, you get a fully integrated e-commerce with unlimited physical and digital products. Of course, a mobile store, inventory tracking. They'll calculate tax for you. They'll calculate shipping. You can do coupon controls. This is, if you want to sell online, just the best way to do it. Squarespace.com. And they're so confident that they give you a free 14-day trial of all their features without a credit card, without just, you just try it. Set up a site right now. Import your data. They have importers for all the major blog APIs, WordPress, Typepad, Blogger. You don't need a credit card. Just sign up. Try it. If you decide to buy it, that's when you'll need a credit card and our offer code. Because we're going to get you 10% off your first purchase. That's why a yearly purchase makes even more sense. When you use the offer code TWIT6, T-W-I-T, and the number 6, that'll let them know you heard about it on TWIT, which is good for us. And it'll save you 10% on your first purchase, which is good for you. Squarespace.com. Just simply the best place to start your next website. Or move your website there.
Love Squarespace.
Yeah, isn't it great? Do you have a Squarespace site, Jason?
Yep, I do. JasonHatter.com.
Cool. Yeah, awesome. If anybody who's used the content management systems that the legacy publishers use really appreciates how nice it is to use a Squarespace iPad or iPhone app and or the website.
All CMSs suck, but some suck a little less than others.
Yeah, they understand that. They've really done it right. I have the new MacBook Air in front of me. A lot of people complaining about Wi-Fi connectivity issues. I have noticed it works really well with the new Apple AirPort Extreme. No problems there.
I didn't have any problems with my review unit, but like you, I've been seeing people commenting that
complaints.
It's been losing. Yeah,
I've noticed that when I'm in my office, it drops a lot, and I think that this doesn't do as well with weak Wi-Fi. Apple has historically had problems with DHCP leases and things. They've had problems with their iPad. It's funny. It's almost new Apple product Wi-Fi problems are almost, you know,
especially the Air for some reason. The last two Airs,
yeah,
we tested, and I had the same Wi-Fi problem with both of them. And
now in both cases,
the first patch fixed it.
Yeah, they were able to fix it in software. So it's not a hardware issue, or at least it hasn't been in the past. It's and a firmware fix almost always seems to fix it. According to Ars Technica, one user says every 15 to 30 minutes, it just drops off. Turn the Wi-Fi off and on again. It's fine. I don't know what it is. It's maybe a heating problem. Gizmodo says it's worse when the computer's on a desk. Mine's been really reliable, again, with the AirPort Extreme. In here, we have flaky Wi-Fi. I have had quite a few drops. Not in here. It's been fine in here. It's in my office. So I'm thinking maybe if it's a marginal signal, it's a bigger problem. On the other hand, it's exactly like the old MacBook Air. It's even a little slower.
Just with twice the battery life.
Yeah.
The battery's insane.
It's great battery life. I'll testify for that. But it's a little slower. Looks exactly. It's got two microphones. So two holes. What were you getting for battery life?
How come it's slower?
Yeah, it's got the clock speed's slower, and so it's coming out.
Oh. But the turbo's the same. The turbo's the same. The clock speed's a little bit lower, and it's more power efficient. In my side-by-side test, and my main everyday use laptop is the 2012 MacBook Air, I really didn't notice any difference between the two in terms of speed.
It's functionally the same.
Synthetics, in synthetic tests, it might be a little slower in some things, but then the GPU is faster and the SSD is faster, so that overcompensates in some cases.
Right.
So I have this weird thing. This may just be me, and I've not been able to confirm this. The 2011 MacBook Air woke from sleep faster than either 2012
I got a fix for you.
Or 2013. Do you have the fix for this?
I do. Because I've applied it to this. Apple on both the MacBook Retina and the MacBook Air puts it into a deeper sleep mode and has to load in. And so there's this 15 second, and then you can type. right?
Yes.
Very frustrating. Yes. Renee Ritchie told me about this.
We're so spoiled, right? You expect it. That was the one thing I always loved about the MacBook Air. You flip the lid open, you start typing right away.
So if you don't mind that you're going to lose some battery life when it's sleeping, because in order to get better battery life, what they did is they made it to a deeper sleep.
Okay.
You can fix this. There's a website, EWAL.net. Fixing slow wake for MacBook Pro with Retina display. It turns out it's on the Air and the new Air especially. I found it. And you'll do a terminal command, PM set, which is a power manager command. So you can see, go open the terminal, see what your settings are with PM set dash G. PM set dash A will change the stand. You can change the standby delay. In this example, he set it to 24 hours. It's a sudo command, so you have to sudo. Yeah, somebody in the front row is doing it right now. You ready? Yep. Type along with me. Sudo space. You got terminal? He's waiting. It's waking up. Isn't it annoying? Because that's the best thing about Airs and MacBooks in general is you open them up and they're ready to go.
Boom.
So everybody's getting theirs out. Sudo sudo space PM set. That's power management settings, space dash A, space standby delay, and then set it for the number of seconds you want. 86,400 seconds is 24 hours. I haven't found it makes that much difference in battery life. If you really wanted to, you know, after a day, it will go into the deeper sleep. Then hit return. You'll have to log in, of course, because you need to be an administrator to do this. That's the sudo. And it just, then it wakes up.
Thank you,
Leo. Close it. It wakes right up.
Thank you. Brilliant. We're going to write an article about this on Tech Republic.
Well, thank Renee Ritchie of iMore. He's the one now. Okay. I put it to sleep and it's not waking up at all. But that's that's another mess. See, it woke up right away, didn't it? Yeah, it works. All right. We have a front row tester. He's born in Texas, so you know he's honest. Seriously, mine's now dead. Oh, you're seeing it.
I can see it. So I think it decided to go into clamshell mode.
It's in clamshell mode.
So just unplug the...
That's because we have an adapter. You're right. Exactly right. Wow, that's interesting. As soon as I closed it, it said, oh, you're on a big screen. All right. Now I don't know what's going on. All right, there we go. Sorry about that. With a little tech support there for Jason, but I think it's very important that everybody gets
this
fixed.
Hey, can we give a shout-out to a story request? Can we give a shout-out to... or not even a shout out so much, but an RIP to Ed Iacobucci from Citrix.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. Ed is, I've known Ed for years, and he passed away of, he had actually pancreatic cancer, survived almost a year and a half, which is very unusual for a serious cancer like that. Isn't that what Steve Jobs had too, isn't it? But he passed away recently. He was only 59, very young guy. But let's tell you who Ed Iacobucci was. He was an engineer at IBM working on the new IBM PC. He was writing OS 2 when he was part of a very famous brain swap with Microsoft. OS 2 engineers went to Redmond to work on NT, and Microsoft engineers went over to IBM, to Armonk to work, or maybe it was Boca, to work on OS 2. Remember, OS 2 had Windows built in. Remember that? So Ed ended up writing, apparently... according to urban legend, which I think is true, much of the code for Windows, the first Windows NT kernel, and learned so much about the innards of it that he was able to then create the best remote desktop product, and one that's still widely used in enterprise, called Citrix. Founded Citrix in 1989, ran the company for about 10 years, maybe more, and went on to other things. Citrix, by the way, is a very big sponsor, I'm sure, of many of your sites as well as ours. They really contribute back to the web. In fact, I think in many ways, Twit wouldn't exist if Citrix weren't such a big sponsor.
They're one of the good guys.
They really are one of the good guys. Ed left. He started NetJets. Remember, that was a timeshare for corporate jets and other things. But really a great guy. One of the most beloved figures. Did you run into him, Jason? Did you know him?
No, it was a little bit before my time. I'm a fan, you know the story, and fan of the work that he did at Citrix. Yeah. And he was trying to do it the right way too. Gina Smith on a new domain.net had a really nice little memorial article.
She stayed in touch with Ed. She had introduced me to Ed, and we palled around at Comdex. That's how long ago this was.
Oh, nice.
Quite a bit. And Ed was always fun. Just a nice, sweet guy. And so, yeah, Gina would be a good obituary to read because she was good friends with Ed. She knew him.
Yes,
well.
I'll post that article on Twitter. And she talked about the fact where he had done. Yeah, you there you go. You got it up. Where he had done some of this really important work at the time. And it was contentious, right? The OS2 Microsoft thing. And the cool thing, which shows, I think, how pragmatic Ed was and probably a little bit, what a good leader he was. He later went back to Microsoft and worked with them very effectively from the point of view of Citrix, because they signed an important agreement that really set the groundwork for some of the things that went into Windows that, you know, predated really as we were getting into virtualization and cloud computing and all of that, a lot of the work that Citrix did and Microsoft then first partnered with and then sort of emulated that.
Well, RDP is licensed from Citrix. Remote desktop is a Citrix product. Nobody did remote desktop better, and Microsoft was wise, I think, to invest.
Yeah, and a lot of that technology laid the groundwork for some of the stuff that's really important to what we're doing today with virtualization and cloud computing and other stuff in enterprise as well. So he definitely deserves a hat tip from all of us. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad you reminded me. I almost forgot. And having been lucky enough to know Ed, he really was a sweetheart. He's, you know, sometimes in this business, you meet business guys who are cutthroat or, aggressive, or sometimes, so a lot of times you meet people like Steve Jobs who think they're the smartest guy in the room. Of course, Steve was right, but they let you know it. Not Ed. He was often the smartest guy in the room, but always very unassuming and real and genuine and fun to be with. So thank you, Jason, for reminding me. Wouldn't want to miss that. Yeah. And he will be missed. Gosh, 59 seems very young to me.
Yeah.
Wonder why. Let's see. What else? Tim Cook. To go from the charismatic Ed Iacobucci and Steve Jobs to Tim. Tim, I'm sure, is a great manager. He's not Mr. Charisma. Not Mr. Charisma. He has changed his bonus stock to be more performance-oriented. Actually, was his request. So originally, he was going to be awarded 1 million stock units, two lump sums over 10 years. It's now a performance-based compensation. I like the confidence of a guy who says, you know what? Let's do this right. If I do good, I make money. If I don't, I don't. So he'll get 100,000 units in August 2016, another 100,000 in 2021. The remaining 800,000 will be allocated over 10 years, depending on how well how the company does. So that's good.
That's good. Look, there's a lot of ways to lead, you know? And
that's the way to do it, isn't it?
Not everybody has to be a Steve Jobs.
Right.
Not everybody is an Ed Iacobucci either, right? A very sort of humble leader.
Right.
That's a different model. But this is sort of, I think it is the right way. You know, you should be rewarded only when you do well. All the sort of golden parachutes and other things that leaders do today to only protect themselves and not protect their companies is not always great, and it's not a good model. Like, this is a good model. If he performs, he does well. If he doesn't, you know, they'll move on, and so will he.
I have a lot of respect for him, although after WWDC, it seems like the superstar in terms of presentation is Craig Federighi. Wasn't he good?
Oh, he was amazing. He was amazing. I was really excited to see that they gave him a chance to shine, because at past events, he would maybe get a little bit of time, but it was always the Scott Forstall show. And Scott, you know what? Wasn't that great of a presenter. And Craig was awesome. Yeah. I mean, he was really riveting. And we were all talking while we were watching the live streams in our office. And it was funny. It was one of those things. I was turning to one of our business reporters, and he was like, "Who is that guy?" I was like, "That's Craig." And we were like, "Yeah, he's amazing." And I definitely think that after that showing, he should be their like key presenter from now on.
Yeah. Very impressive.
He was funny too. He was, it was a very different vibe, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
no, he had great personality, which you almost never see in even the best demos. It's rare to see someone who has just a really good sense of humor and a good sense of the crowd and just was congenial. And you know, and it was different. You know, Steve obviously had the charisma and the polish, but he was just a really comfortable presenter and seemed perfectly at home with the audience. So
the last telegram ever will be sent in India next month. Can you believe that? Telegrams. Dead.
Well, the story isn't that they're sending the last one. It's that they were still sending telegrams.
they were still sending them at all.
It's true.
Yeah, 160 years ago, Samuel Morse sent the first telegram in 1844. Yes. And the creator of Morse code. And apparently, Indian state-run telecommunications company continues to send telegrams. They're losing $23 million a year on it. 5,000 telegrams are sent a day in India, but considering the population, that's not that many. Most of them are sent by the government. So that's it. The last telegram. Western Union got out of the telegraph business in 2006.
It does feel weird that this is actually a technology that is dying. I mean, it of course it happens all the time, but it's so closely like it's the dinosaur of what we do today of the internet.
Right.
It's the first telecommunication, and it's actually disappearing. It's not going to be. It feels. I don't know why, but it feels strange.
Well, before there was ASCII, there was Morse code. It really is a precursor in many ways of what we do today. So I think it's appropriate to mark its change.
Yeah. Samuel Morse also created one of the greatest paintings in American history. Talk
Isn't
about
that
a
funny?
Guy.
Yeah,
he's awesome. Amazing painter.
He gave up painting.
Gallery of the Louvre by Samuel Morse, one of the greatest paintings in American history.
Yeah. It's a very strange, you know, I found out about that in
David McCullough's book.
Yeah. David McCullough's book about Americans who went to Paris, and he was one of them, and a great painter. And then he gave it up. And then he tells the story of Morse code, how it came about. I forgot what.
Yeah, it was actually he got that from in France too.
The French invented it. You know what? It was the signal fires, wasn't it? It was signal fires. So
yes,
that's a big leap.
Like that.
But they would so if they you know the invaders the Anglo-Saxons are coming across. They would light the signal fire at Cherbourg, and then it would go, and there'd be some sort of code. And he saw that. He said, boy, I wonder if you could use that. Maybe we could do a telegraph. I don't know. Dots and dashes. Yes. And there's the painting. And the reason it's an interesting painting is because of all the people in it.
Yes. That's his, over on the left, the guy painting. Oh, is that I think that's the guy. He's very famous American sculptor. In the back is James with his family. He's James Fenimore Cooper in the back corner.
With the Deer Slayer.
Yeah, and Last of the Mohicans.
Yep.
This is supposedly his daughter or that he's leaning. This is actually him in the center of the portrait is him leaning over the shoulder. That's his daughter who is also a portrait painter.
I wish we had an Audible ad today because this is such a great book.
It is a great book.
And I read it on Audible.
And this is the Mona Lisa's in here too, which is interesting. This is before the Mona Lisa was known as a very important Da Vinci painting, but it was not she was not the international superstar that she was yet, because you know what made her an international superstar was she was stolen in the early 1900s.
That's right.
And that's when she became, and she was missing for 2 years out of the Louvre, right? And so that's when she became an international icon. But he wisely had her in there. And that's a sort of a tour de force and Renaissance painting, the ones that he put in. These weren't the real paintings that were in this room. He actually put them there.
Yeah.
He went, found his best favorite ones in the Louvre, put them in there. And the great thing is now that gallery that's there, that actually is their gallery of Renaissance paintings today.
It's amazing.
Kind of cool.
Samuel F.B. Morse not only painted that painting, but invented telegraphy. And by the way, we should point out Morse code is still widely used just because telegraphy's gone. Mm-hmm. Many, many hams use CW. Morse code is still very much in use. It's a great way actually, to break through when there's bad radio noise. You can break through.
If he was inspired by the French smoke signals of some kind, you all owe us a lot of money.
Yeah, I think that's where's your royalty? It's a good thing you didn't patent that.
I was going to say
we're the book is.
We have prior art.
Yeah. Yeah,
remember, this is the same period where Charles Dickens was coming to America and telling, you know, really ticked off, basically did this tour and was really ticked off because all the printers here were printing his books and not
That's
giving
right.
him a cut of the proceeds.
That's right. The more things change, the more they remain the same. Or as you would say, la plus ça change, the plus le même chose. The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris, is a really, it's a surprising subject, but it's a fascinating, you know, that's where the great medical schools were. Was
yeah.
Paris. So all the doctors in the 19th century went
that
to Paris.
That part with Morse and James Fenimore Cooper, who became really good friends there, that's my favorite part of that book. That book is really kind of it's almost like a collection of different stories of people. And there's a lot of great stuff in there. But the part with Morse and Cooper is really spectacular.
You know what else we stole from you? The cross sandwich.
I wouldn't say you stole it from us. Let's say it was inspired by real events. Is that how you know, inspired or yeah?
It was a fair trade for the, what was it? The Le Royale?
The Royal Cheese.
The Royal Cheese.
Well, actually, I will take that trade. I love McDonald's.
Okay, that's sad. Too much information. Google Fiber spawns startup renaissance in Kansas City, according to Marguerite Reardon, writing on CNET. I think this makes a lot of sense. Give us gigabit and we'll give you all sorts of new businesses, all sorts of innovation. I think this is what Google wanted to prove, really. Homes for Hackers project. I think startup village inside Kansas City. I think that's fabulous.
They couldn't have scripted this any better, right?
It's just what you want.
Could not have scripted that.
Yeah.
Right. That's exactly what they were hoping would happen.
So let's talk about the Xbox 180. A lot of heat on Microsoft. I was surprised, really. There was a lot of heat on Microsoft for their DRM policies. The new Xbox One, which will be out in the fall sometime, in its earliest incarnation, wouldn't allow people to share games. You could give a game to somebody, but only if you'd known them online in Xbox Live for more than 30 days. There might not be a game resale market at all. The Xbox One always had to be on the internet at least every 24 hours. It would check to make sure that the games you were playing you owned. All sorts of stuff. And I think Microsoft really fumbled this one because when, for instance, troops on the front line complained that, well, that's going to make it impossible for us to use, you know, in Afghanistan and other places where U.S. soldiers are fighting because we don't have guaranteed internet access, Microsoft's President Don Matrick said, well, the only people I could see a problem with is if you're in a submarine and you guys should buy an Xbox 360.
Lovely.
Yeah. I think... this is, according to Mary Jane Foley and Paul Thurrott on our Windows Weekly show, Matrick was called under the carpet and said, all right, you got a choice. It's the Scott Forstall situation. Remember, Scott was told, you will apologize for maps. He said, no, I will not. They said goodbye at Apple. Matrick was supposedly told, you will apologize for this, or you will write a blog post retracting everything, and Matrick chose the latter. He's still working at Microsoft. They call it the Xbox 180. I can't think of a single time a big company like Microsoft has made such a U-turn.
This thing's the Windows 8 of this is the Windows 8 of consoles.
It's the second time in 2 months.
I mean, Paul Thurrott wrote that. I thought he was dead on.
Yep.
You know, the thing is even people that I know that are hardcore gamers, not really excited about that. Xbox One. I think they went in the wrong direction with this. They're trying to go more media player, but media player is not a $500 box. And yeah, the Xbox 360, I think, has gotten real popular, but it got real popular once it was $199, right? I'm just not sure that that they can do much with this. Completely not backward compatible. I mean, a lot of times these consoles aren't backward compatible or aren't backward compatible with everything, but this one is completely unbackward compatible, still at $500. The target market for this was already narrow, right? For a console, it has gotten narrower and narrower, and then they made it even more narrow by keeping it at $500, making it a media box, competing with what are now mostly $100 media boxes.
See, I go the other way. I think Microsoft was forward-looking. They knew that discs were dead. And they said, well, look, you know, everybody's going to be downloading games. That's the future. And we don't need to worry about a used disc market. That's a silly thing to worry about.
That part is right, but they're going in the wrong. They're going too high with this without discs and without having to include sort of a disc player in there. I mean, there's still lots of Xbox 360 games that are not disc based that still could be backward compatible, right? I mean, it could run in a VM.
No, it couldn't because it's a totally different architecture.
It's true. It's a different architecture.
It's x86. Yeah,
but you can still model the architecture.
But if you are having to recreate a PowerPC thing, even in an emulator, to do the Xbox 360 graphics, I mean, I honestly, the computing power and the RAM that would take, I mean, Sony's not doing it either. I mean, I genuinely think that it would be way more trouble than it's worth, which is why, you know, the understanding will be people will just buy a new one. I mean, it's been 7 years. If you want to continue to play your old games, you buy them. You know, I mean, I don't begrudge them that. And I think pricing, they're about even with Sony on. I think they lost a PR battle.
I think they miscommunicated and they got smacked.
Because there were some features that, you know, when you think about it, were actually quite attractive. The idea that you could have a cloud collection of all your games, for instance, which is now no longer going to be the case. So even if you bought a game on disc before, you could then access that game from anyone else's system. That's a really compelling offering, and you could share games, you know, with up to 10 members of your family or whatever, or friends or whatever. Those were, I think, compelling ideas, but they didn't sell it the right way, and I think it was primarily a marketing and a PR failure, and they've had to backtrack.
It's going to be an interesting battle this fall between the
$500, though? I mean, who's going to buy it at $500?
I already bought it.
You already bought it. So, Leo, who's going to buy it?
Of course, partly I have to, right? But and I'll probably buy a PS4 too. But I like it. I like the idea of watching football and having stats come up, and I don't know. I liked it.
All right.
Seemed good to me.
I'm looking at
I think that's honestly why they had to do the PR turnaround, though, was because even though the idea of used games is going to be determined by the publishers now, more so than by the console makers. And even though, you know, the idea that the disc-based games are going to become less and less of a reality, especially as we all get Google Fiber and that sort of thing, the notion that the early market of people who are willing to pay $500 for a console or $400 plus $60 for an eye accessory for a PlayStation are going to balk at any perceived slight of having less access to their stuff. And if you're going to potentially piss off that early base of the people who are willing to spend $500 on your product, you could potentially be, dead before you hit the market.
Do you think do you think Microsoft's going to go into the marketplace in Christmas and nobody's going to buy it?
No, I think it'll be. I think now they're fine. I think if
now
they
it's okay.
Yeah, I think if they had, and I think that by the time it launches, most people will have forgotten about the entire flop up because they backtracked fast enough and early enough.
Isn't it possible that console gaming in general is dead? The games are $60.
Yes.
You know, Sony may say we're not going to have any DRM. Of course, they're going to have DRM. Do you think Electronic Arts is going to let them do anything they want?
No, they're not. I mean, that's the thing. Sony's saying that they won't have it on their own end, but if the publisher wants to prevent, users from selling back a game or whatever, they can. And of course, all the publishers will. But I mean, a lot of people have predicted that this is the last kind of generation of the traditional console, and they might be right.
Yeah,
I think that they are all now moving into media devices.
Yeah.
But I also think that the one potential area of interest for me with Xbox would be if they could do to a large degree what they did with Xfinity and with Verizon Fios, to maybe make it act as a cable box. Because when you look at the internal guts and you look at what the, you know, different high-end cable boxes are, if you could basically make your Xbox also act as that, and you didn't have to pay, you know, a monthly rental fee for your cable company or whatnot, then it could kind of become a true, you know, home media device, and it might offset the initial cost. Although, of course, they're going to, you know, bring it down lower before it gets a lot of mainstream adoption.
Sales will disappoint on this. They'll sell way more Xbox 360s than they'll sell Xbox Ones this year, even if they stop selling Xbox 360.
Yeah, yeah.
They've said very clearly they won't. I mean, I think that if they can actually lower the price of the 360 down to $100, then Apple TV, Roku, everybody should be really scared. Because at that point, you're talking about a $100 machine that is a tremendous media player and also has still a really great game library.
And a really loud fan. Actually, it's not as loud as it used to be. Sorry.
But no more blue red rings of death. They'll be blue now. Right. Which is, I think, a big improvement. Yes. What do you know Alamogordo, New Mexico for, right? White Sands Laboratory, right? First test of the atomic bomb, right? It's also where E.T. was buried. The cartridge. A Canadian film crew is going to Alamogordo, New Mexico to a landfill site to dig up Atari's E.T. video game. The urban legend was this game was so bad, written in just a few weeks to capitalize on the success of the movie E.T., it was so bad, Atari was so embarrassed, and they were thinking that it was going to ruin the appeal of the 2600. They bulldozed millions of cartridges in Alamogordo, New Mexico. No one knows the truth of it, but this Canadian company, this film company, is gonna try to dig it up.
God, remember when Milli Vanilli? Remember when they had all when everybody got rid of their Milli Vanilli albums and they started bulldozing those?
Yes, and they had the steamrollers. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Just because they lip synced? Come on.
That's what made me think of.
Yeah. Oh, come on, man. I was like 7 when that happened.
Were you
that
mad?
I remember just being like, wow, they were faking. I remember not being able to believe that they pulled it off, you know, so well. But no, I wasn't really mad.
I think this is another thing that's changed.
When I saw them getting bulldozed, I thought, man, I'm going to hold on to mine. This is going to be valuable because everybody's getting rid of theirs.
So it's been 15 years. How valuable is it?
I still have it. It's in my parents', you know, my parents' house somewhere.
I have an E.T. Atari cartridge.
You do?
I do. So my sister is 6 years older than me. And so the Christmas of 82, which was right after I was born, she really wanted the E.T. game for the Atari. And my mom went all over Atlanta to every toy store and every, like, you know, Kmart and whatnot, trying to find the game. Because at the time, you know, right in time for Christmas, it was really hard to find. My mom busted her butt to find this game, which is the worst game ever.
Is it really? Have you played it?
Oh, I have. Oh, it's terrible. Oh,
what's
it's
so
terrible.
Bad? Oh, you. Oh, I want to play it.
I actually remember that game.
The emulators, they're emulators.
I remember
available
it
online.
Too.
It's really hard to even get through one level. I mean, it's so poorly coded that if you don't do things just right, I mean, it's terrible. Like, I remember playing it as a kid when I found the old Atari and hooked it up, and I didn't know the lore behind the game, and I just remember thinking, "What is this?" It was like that. The Contra game were like the two like worst game. Contra for NES were like the two worst games that I remember in my life. And the E.T. game is just, oh, wow. I mean, it's bad.
Has anybody ever beat the E.T. game?
I don't even know if you can. I think that's part of the lore is that because it's so poorly programmed, it's hard to even get through all the way. Like you've almost got to like hack the ROM to a certain extent to like fix it, even get all the way through. I mean, that was why the video game industry died and why Nintendo bought it back because of stuff like that.
Is this going to give you chills if I play this?
Oh, no, do it.
Oh, awesome.
Big sense Pac-Man. As in the movie, E.T. is brought to Earth by his spaceship and gets stranded in the woods. The
those
object,
are woods,
if you didn't
folks,
know,
in case you didn't
is
know.
To get E.T. home. You must locate 3 pieces of his intergalactic telephone, call his spaceship, and get him to the landing site in time. Otherwise, the spaceship leaves without him.
When you do, when
you
the
can
spaceship
build bonus
leaves,
points
it does
by
play
picking
the
up the candy piece.
The real soundtrack. In each scene. In Muzak.
Learn to recognize the various symbols that appear.
Yeah, really, all the Atari could do is. I mean. They weren't the greatest sound effects.
A question mark is a find phone zone that will show you which well in the scene, if any, contains a piece of the phone. To retrieve it,
what is this video?
This is a walkthrough.
Raise ET's neck and levitate him.
This is a walkthrough.
Fall right back into the same well.
How to beat ET?
There are only four scenes containing wells, two of which you have to navigate fairly slow.
Who put the effort into this and then posted it on YouTube? That's what I want to know.
I hope that it shows when the ship is going is pulling away. I totally remember.
Does this all come back to you?
Oh, yeah.
Should I skip ahead to the finale?
Skip ahead, see if they have the ship, where the ship comes.
Who's that?
That's one of the government agents.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He's wearing a bunny suit.
He can repel these two enemies. And, of course, E.T. can always run away from them. Though that
kids, this is what video gaming was like when mommy and daddy were young. You off
unless it's the only way.
Well, I would argue that's not exactly what it was like.
The graphics were so bad.
They put ET in jail. Wow.
Wow. So let me.
Oh,
I just
they didn't have the ship.
This is from TR0D on YouTube. How to beat home video games part two. I love it. Oh my goodness! All right, let's. We'll play a John. I don't know if we can. There you go. Are you playing the game now, Chad? Did you find the game?
No, this is a video.
This is just somebody else just playing it.
But, yeah. Wow. You know, no context, you know, from the...
Apparently, there's somebody who's gone through the ROM and tried to recode it. Neocomputer.org. Fixing...
Bye, E.T.
Okay, that's a weird video, sorry.
I was just thinking that I bet somebody went back and tried to fix that.
And try to
fix whatever problems there were. That's awesome.
So this is a whole website saying why ET is so bad and how it can be fixed. And so apparently if you can open your NTSC ET ROM in a hex editor, you can make
that's brilliant.
That's so great. I love the internet, man.
Gosh, and there's an Easter egg, a ninja ET. Wow. And you can just download the fixed bin if you have a Atari 2600 emulator.
Somebody in the chat room said they just went and found their ET cartridge.
Wow. We're bringing it back, baby.
Yeah, send a picture. Exactly.
We're going to take a break, and then we'll talk about John McAfee. Real quickly, if you have a gadget gathering dust in your garage, my garage is a mess, in a drawer, in a closet, Gazelle will buy it from you. They'll even buy broken iPhones and give you cash, good cash, American hard cash money. iPhones, cell phones from BlackBerry, HTC, LG, Motorola, Nokia, Samsung, iPads of any generation, even tablets from Asus and Amazon, Google and Microsoft. Even Microsoft, yes, if you want to sell your Surface RT, finally you found somebody who'll buy it. It's Gazelle, ladies and gentlemen. So here's the deal. These quotes are good for 30 days. No, you're not, you know, you're not making a commitment. You're just going to find out how much it's worth. So get your free offer, good for 30 days. You have time to pull your data off, see if something better came along. Then ship it to Gazelle on anything worth more than a buck. They'll pay for the shipping. They send you a mailer. And then you get paid fast. You could get a check, a PayPal credit, which is right away. But my suggestion is get the Amazon gift card. They bump it up 5%. It's worth even more. Gazelle.com. You may wonder, who uses this? Well, they've paid over $100 million out to 500,000 customers. It's a great way. They'll even wipe your data for free. Free shipping, fast processing, and they'll take your Surface RT. Gazelle, look at that. Third generation iPad, 32 gigs Wi-Fi, $200. No iPads are coming. This is the time. Get a quote, because I tell you what, these things aren't gaining in value. Even your ET cartridge is probably not worth a lot more.
Especially your ET cartridge.
Especially. Gazelle, GAZELLE.com. Sell your gadgets the fast and easy way with Gazelle. I can't play the John McAfee video because it's too profane and bizarre. What do you guys make of that one?
Wow.
Yeah. It's
it is him.
What?
Yeah, it is him.
I guess we should probably describe what happens for the people who
I'll play it, but don't play the audio, Chad, because we're not quick. There's so much profanity in it that we cannot edit it entirely. It's 2.5 minutes and 4.5 minutes. It's a message from the founder of McAfee Software. There he is, John McAfee. And apparently it's all about him being pissed off because he wrote, he says, this nice little software 15 years ago, the McAfee antivirus. He sold it. It's owned by Intel now. Long ago, he got the money and moved to Belize. And he says they screwed up my nice little program. And he actually, the whole thing is, how do you uninstall McAfee?
Because he gets email from tons of people asking him how, you know, because he's obviously he is John McAfee, and people want to know
how to jail.
No. He came back, and now he's apparently with his child brides cavorting all over the United States.
He's in the U.S. He's not in Belize.
No, he's back. He's back, and apparently he's just they're living it up in Portland because you know
that's
Portland is, well, you know what,
that's where this whiskey
can't make
came
the story
from.
Any weirder. You know what I mean? Like this is yeah. My favorite part is but, when he has
actually,
the bath salts.
Sorry,
which
Christina.
He snorts bath salts in the video. Which
right.
was
that's the thing. The video becomes starts out as him at his desk with his, you know, very fancy. Well, there you go.
Smoking jacket, his very fancy smoke.
And then there's a fake nerd who's going to show you how to remove McAfee, but he can't do it. And then look at this. Okay. So what's going right. on? There's boxes of bath salts here. Firearms of a variety of kinds. How many child brides is that? I'm counting six.
It's a harem.
It's a harem. You know,
and then
this,
they start getting naked.
This is Charlie Sheen crazy.
Yes. This is the fatal flaw in all this is that McAfee, the assumption that McAfee software was ever good, and
that's
somehow
right.
it actually went bad.
Now, does anyone else find it ironic that the guy, that the nerd they've got, kind of looks like Peter Norton?
He needs a wider tie.
He does, but it kind of looks like Peter Norton a little
bit.
Oh,
you're right. I wonder if that's intentional. This is the strangest thing I've ever seen. Some people, I noticed a lot of people thought it was funny. I didn't think it was funny. I just thought, but this is bizarre.
Creepy. It's creepy.
It's a little creepy.
It is creepy. I don't know what he's trying to accomplish with this. Is he just trying to annoy his, you know, former company, or I'm not sure what he wants.
He wants to show off his rockin' bod.
I think he's just, these are everything everyone's attention. Saying about me. You all say I'm crazy. Let me show you how crazy I am. I mean, you know, I think he's just, it's a Charlie Sheen sort of like F you to the wind.
Right.
It's an entertaining spectacle, but at the same time, it's kind of sad. You know, you're kind of like,
this is the,
should we really be paying attention to this? Cause this just begets more crazy.
Okay.
We should just
Let's just pretend it didn't happen.
Here.
He does end up uninstalling the software using the 44 solution.
And very bad special effects.
This worst.
Yes. The worst green screening ever.
So weird. Just so weird. All right. I guess we couldn't go through the show without mentioning that anyway. All right. Here, we'll cleanse our palate with a good story. Aaron's Law has finally been introduced. Zoe Lofgren and Jim Sensenbrenner in the House, Ron Wyden in the Senate, introduced a law to reform the CFAA so that it no longer can be used against people, you know, for ridiculous things like violation of a website's terms of service, lying about your age on Facebook, checking personal email on a work computer. All of these were deemed by the Department of Justice to be felonies, and allowing the government to imprison Americans for a violation of a non-negotiable private agreement dictated by a corporation.
Yeah, ridiculous.
So the proposal is designed to kind of focus the law back to its intentions so that it really is, you know, about computer fraud, not you know, lying on Facebook.
And this is using the law
pass,
to,
right?
you know, for using a law to do something that it wasn't meant to do,
right?
Because you want to sort of persecute someone or attack them.
Well, and this really, and it's sad because Aaron's dead and nothing that we can do can bring him back.
Yes.
But this this really is circling around to our initial discussion about prison. This is exactly PRISM. This is exactly the problem, which is these laws exist. They're on the books and they can be used to persecute in a way that is, you know, appalling. And if they've got the material, you know, they've got all the data on their servers, they can find ways to, you know, send you to jail.
So this law is going to pass, right? It's probably...
I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, I don't know.
Because the proposal is nice, but if it doesn't actually get...
Well, they finally made it a bill, so it's a step. Although, yeah. I don't... It doesn't look like it has a number yet. So they've introduced it, but boy, I just... Look, again, when you're writing your member of Congress about PRISM, you might want to just say, hey, by the way, that Aaron's law, let's pass
Please
that
support.
Too.
Yep.
Can you support that too? Just as long as you're, because it's just wide open to prosecutorial abuse,
yes.
as we saw in the case of Aaron Swartz, who really was hounded, persecuted, and inappropriately. And I don't know if it'll pass, Patrick.
Something to keep track, to track.
Yeah, right, absolutely. Right, your member of Congress. Patrick Beja, it's great to have you and to get an international perspective on the craziness that is going on here in the United States. Always a pleasure. Where should people go if they want to? Not Patrick on Twitter. That's a good start.
Yes. At not Patrick is always good. You can go to patrickbeja.com, actually. That's probably the starting point to everything I do. So you can go there and you'll find something that will be interesting, hopefully including a couple of French language shows that you should enjoy if you like Twit.
Le Rendezvous Tech.
Exactly.
I like saying it so much. I sound like Pepe Le Pew. Do you have Pepe Le Pew in France, and does he have an American accent?
no, but I've been in contact with enough Americans that I know exactly.
They probably say that to you all the time. I'm sorry. Yes. I'm just another dumb American.
There
I'm
are
sorry.
Two things. American, not dumb. there are two things.
That would be go ahead. Redundant.
I'm not going to say it.
Yeah.
The Pepe Le Pew thing and for some reason, I don't know why. This is assumed to be something that we say.
Wait. Are you saying that French people don't go, ho, ho, ho?
I don't want to shock too many people, so I'm not going to go for it.
All right. Do you at least say, ooh la la?
We say something. No, we don't. I'm
Sacré
sorry.
Bleu?
Sacre bleu, actually, yes.
Oh,
we
good.
Do say sacre bleu. So there you go. You have one
out of five.
All right.
Thank heavens for little girls. You sing that, right?
Which one?
Never mind. I'm sorry. I even brought it up. No, I'm just every stereotype in the book.
Well, we have probably worse stereotypes about you guys.
Ah.
So it's only fair.
Now, I was told that French people like the American accent. When we speak French and we don't do our R's right, you think that's cute.
It's lovely.
Yeah, see, it's lovely.
Yeah.
Not when a guy does it, but when an attractive young lady says, bonjour, où est la gare, you go, oh, she's so cute.
Yes.
Yes. I don't know.
We absolutely do. And, you know, guys too. We don't discriminate.
We like the French accent here, so it's mutual. Anyway, I'm just teasing you. It's great to talk to you again, Patrick.
Thank you for
Patrick,
having me.
Beja.
Exactly.
BEJA.com. Thank you so much, Jason Heiner. Always a pleasure. What's going on at Tech Republic? Anything you want to plug?
So we have something new that we're going to be launching. I can't say.
Please don't
it is,
tell me it's your big video effort, your new podcast network. Please say
nope,
that.
Nope, it is okay. Not. Does not involve video or podcasting, but it does involve helping people who are, you know, working some of the toughest jobs in the world in the tech industry, trying to keep the world running and trying to make really smart decisions on how to put technology to good use in business.
Love
so,
it.
Yes. More on that in the coming weeks.
TechRepublic.com. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Leo.
And I really want to thank you, Christina, for bearing up under this intense scrutiny here at the Twit Cottage. Nice to have you. You're just fabulous film girl on Mashable. Mashable
thank
is doing
so
a massive video effort, of which Christina is, of course, the star. And you do a great job. Are you baffled
you
by
so
this
much.
Whole
Thanks
thing? Oh, she froze
me.
Solid. Okay. Great to have you.
No, I froze. And yeah. Okay. Am I here? Sorry.
Yes, you're back.
No, I Thank you. I'm back. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You're great. Really enjoyed it. We'll have you back soon, all of you. We do Twit every I've done all the house ads, right? All right. We do Twit every Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 2300 UTC. I've been saying it wrong. 2300 UTC. So watch live if you can on Sundays. And if you can't, well, please download on-demand audio and video. Always available after the fact at twit.tv and wherever finer podcasts are stored. Thank you for being here. We'll see you next time. Another Twit
is in the can.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.